Mr. Chair?
Good morning, members of the board, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the regular meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board for the La Hutton Region. My name is Pete Pumphrey, and I am the board chair. I want to thank you for coming to our meeting. We welcome your comments, ideas, and participation because they help us to do a better job. I want to thank you also for your patience with the traffic. I'm learning a little bit about patience these 2 days, a lesson that I can always stand to have reinforced for me. At this time, I would like to introduce the other members of the regional board: Don Jardine from Markleyville, Eric Sandell from Truckee, Keith Diaz from Rosamond, Kimberly Cox from Hellendale, and Dr. Amy Horn from Truckee. Our executive officer is Patty Kuyumjin. Ms. Kuyumjin, would you please introduce the staff who are with us this morning?
Yes, good morning, everyone. Welcome. With us today in staff, I will start to my left, is Katrina Fleshman, who is our board clerk, the one who you will be giving the cards to, and Elizabeth Barrett, who is our legal counsel. We're very lucky to have in our audience also State Board Member Sean McGuire, who will be presenting later. We also have from the State Board Brianna St. Pierre, who has joined us. And we have, I believe, I'm not sure if Elaine, Laura McClellan's in the audience yet. There you go, from our State Water Board. And Dr. Elaine Kahn from OEHA will be talking to us. So let me introduce the rest of our La Hutton staff. Doug Smith is our Assistant Executive Officer back there. We have Scott Ferguson, one of our division managers, in the audience. We have Patrice Copeland all the way from our Victorville office to one of our division managers. I have Laura Corman in the audience, Norman Russell. Russell Norman. I apologize, Russell. Mike Segillian. I think I saw Mr. Tucker there. Rob Tucker is in the audience. Jahil Cass from our virtual office also in the audience. And I'm not sure. I may have missed some folks, but I apologize. But thank you.
Thank you. The regional board will be considering many items during this meeting. Please feel free to comment on any item so our decision will be made based on all available information. We now webcast our water board meetings, and the link can be found on our agenda sheet. If you wish to speak on an agenda item, please fill out the orange speaker card that's in the back of the room and hand that card to Katrina Fleshman, our board clerk. Please respect board members, staff presenters, and your fellow citizens. Everyone's views should be heard. If a lot of people wish to speak, I may place time limits on presentations. If you have any written materials as part of the agenda item, please hand copies to Katrina Fleshman, and she will distribute them. So that we can have an accurate administrative record, please speak after I call your name and invite you to come to the lectern. Please communicate your ideas clearly and efficiently. We have three items on our agenda this morning, plus a fourth which was carried over from yesterday. The fourth which was carried over from last night is a closed session, and we're not sure where we're going to fit that into this morning's proceedings because we have some time constraints with respect to our board members. So in order to try to help figure that out, it would be very, very useful if anyone who wishes to speak or thinks they might want to speak on any of the items this morning to fill out one of these cards. I'm not trying to dissuade anybody from speaking. We want to hear from you. I'm not trying to suggest that if someone says something, if I say something really stupid during the meeting this morning, that you can't correct me or comment on that. Even though you haven't filled out a yellow card. But if you fill them out now, if you think you're going to speak, that gives us a better idea of how to manage our time this morning to get everything done with a minimum of inconvenience to you folks who have come all the way to be with us. So thank you. Item 7 on the agenda is public forum. Any person may address the Water Board regarding a matter within the Water Board's jurisdiction that is not related to an item on this meeting agenda or currently pending before the Water Board. I don't have any cards, magic cards, for this item. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak to the board during the public forum section of the meeting? If not, item 8 on our agenda is a consideration of Tahoe Keys Lagoon's Aquatic Weed Control Methods Test Project and an update.
Good morning, Chair Pumphrey, members of the board. My name is Russell Norman. I'm a water resource control engineer in the Water Board's Tahoe office and staff lead for permitting of the Tahoe Keys Lagoon's Aquatic Weed Control Methods Test. And well, I'll just refer to this as the project throughout the presentation because that's quite a mouthful to say. At any rate, I'll be co-presenting, or let me back up. The project includes an NPDES permit application as well as an application for a basin plan exemption to the prohibition on discharge of aquatic pesticides. I will be co-presenting the item this morning with Dennis Sabaglo of TRPA. He's the Aquatic Invasive Species Program Lead. And Jen Mayer with Zephyr Collaboration, who is our the facilitator selected for the project. Before we get started with the information item, however, Joanne Marchetto would like to give an opening statement.
Thank you, Russell. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board, and members of the audience. I appreciate very much the invitation today. For the record, Joanne Marchetta. I'm the executive director of the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. So, as I said, I appreciate very much this invitation today from your executive officer, Patty Comunjan, and my good colleague and pal to speak with you and introduce this item today. TRPA has been leading the collaborative work to combat aquatic invasive species in the Tahoe region since we stepped in 2007, just after the invasive zebra mussels were discovered in Lake Tahoe's backyard at Lake Mead. And TRPA is a bi-state regional agency that oversees the implementation with our partners of an approved federal aquatic invasive species management plan for the Tahoe region. And our AIS partnership is broad in this region, many members, and we all agree on one thing, and that is that the number one threat in aquatic invasive species control is at ground zero in the Tahoe Keys lagoons, where the aquatic weeds infestation is serious and it's growing, and it is of increased concern to public health, as well as being an actual threat of spread to other locations all around the lake. The private owners, and most particularly the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association, have been working on the aquatic weeds infestation problem here literally for decades. And in spite of all that effort, there has never been an agreed-upon or clear path forward for those owners, much less a consensus among all the differing interests, the agencies, the public, and the private property owners. So those private owners have tried, and they've tested, and they've tried something else, and they've tested more, and there have never been full solutions to this problem at the Keys, and they have stalled many times. And their frustration is deep, and they want to act. And we sit at the table with them, and they often see too many obstacles. But in 2017, the regulatory agencies and the private parties were at one of the many stalls over the many decades. And once again, we looked at one another, and when we turn with uncertainty on these really, really important and very contentious environmental issues, we said no one wins. And at TRPA, I represent this crucible of disparate opinion and approach, which I'm sure you are no strangers to, but two states, six local governments, the federal government, and often private interests. And we have lots of experience with churn. And it was several years ago that I sat and I said to staff and to our partners, like Lahontan, churn is not helping the threat to the lake or to the Keys. And so we need to do something different to break this logjam. And what we knew from experience was that on these very polarized, very splintered kinds of contentious issues like this one, we needed a more collaborative approach to break that logjam. And so we at TRPA set out to secure funding to partner with the private sector, and we literally said, we can no longer treat this as your problem, meaning the applicant's problem. We had to shift our mindset, and we needed to make the Keys weeds infestation problem our problem, which was really the lake's problem. And so we have to stand together and to protect the lake and its ecosystem and its $5 billion economy. So starting in 2018, we began working with the property owners and other key stakeholders to really develop an entirely different path, and that path is far more collaborative, and your understanding and support of that collaborative approach today is part of the key goal of today's briefing. And I know it can seem odd to some to partner so closely with our regulated private parties, but sometimes progress only happens at the speed of trust. And the problem here is we're trying to navigate this issue in a complex regulatory scheme that is often extremely confusing to the public. Here we have a private owner who's being required by the board, by this board and by TRPA to address a pollutant of concern, in this instance, aquatic invasive weeds. And in that process, among many other evaluation requirements, the applicant is required, and I'm paraphrasing here, so forgive me, but it is required to look at all possible treatment options. And that regulatory posture has affected the public perception of this project, which is partly why it's stalled over time. Because in order to look at all options, the applicant had to apply to Lahontan, to this board, to lift a prohibition on one controversial treatment option, and that was the possible application of approved aquatic herbicides. And that permit application created the unfortunate misimpression to the public, who doesn't understand regulatory process and procedure all that well, that the only treatment option that was being considered was herbicide application. And that permit application created that unfortunate misimpression that we were looking at one option. A key point to understand in this newly configured collaborative process is that there is no presumptive treatment option at the Tahoe Keys, and in fact, all treatment options are under evaluation. And to correct that public misimpression, in fact, this collaborative group of stakeholders has been developing the permit application for treatment options along with the applicant assuring that we are looking at all treatment options. So to build the trust that this is a shared problem, we're actually not only developing the application with the applicant, we're also sharing in the costs to the tune of over $1 million from the Lake Tahoe Restoration Act. That money is going to fund the collaborative facilitation. It's going to the costs of an environmental impact statement, and it's going to help fund portions of the testing. Why would we do that? Why would we go from your problem to our shared problem with so much skin in the game? And what you're going to see is that the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association has been working on this issue for nearly 50 years. So after 50 years, and I have said this to my board as well, it's time. It's time to solve this problem together, because as more time passes and as the clock ticks and no solution is at hand, and the problem is spreading. Boats are literally carrying fragments of these weeds out into Lake Tahoe, and we're seeing new populations. So the risk is growing that the problem is simply going to get away from us and spread to so many other areas of the lake that we have an entirely different problem and a much more dire public problem to solve. I thought this background on the collaborative was important to ground the conversations on this issue, and so I look forward to working with all of you, with your staff, with the collaborative stakeholders, as well as the public, to wrestle some solution here to the ground on what is one of the most serious environmental problems that we're facing here in Tahoe. So I thank you very much for all that you do for the lake and for the state of California, and I turn this back to the chair and the other presenters. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Joanne. So for our information item this morning, I'll provide a brief introduction and background on the Tahoe Keys. Dennis Sabagolo will provide a discussion of aquatic invasive species in Lake Tahoe in general and the Keys in particular. I'll provide information on the proposed project and the basin plan exemption and NPDES permit applications submitted by the Tahoe Keys property owners. And Jen Mayer will provide an update on public and stakeholder engagement for the project. And I'll finish the item with a brief discussion of regulatory considerations associated with the project. And we will conclude with time for questions and answers. The Tahoe Keys development is located south end of Lake Tahoe, in the city of South Lake Tahoe, and is 372 acres in extent, including 170 acres of waterways. The development includes 1,529 homes and townhomes, a marina, and a commercial center. The development is bounded by Lake Tahoe to the north, the U.S. Forest Service Pope Marsh to the west. To the south, we have Forest Service and city property. Over to the east is CTC property and the lower part of the Upper Truckee River Marsh. And then there are two connections within the Keys development. The west channel, and this is to Lake Tahoe, serves the property owners. And then the east channel serves the marina, commercial center, some property owners, and the Tahoe Beach and Harbor Association. There's no connection within the development between the east and west channels, by the way. The test project is proposed to be conducted to control the target aquatic weeds within, the west channel only, the property owner's channel. And the species of concern are your raisin water milfoil, curly leaf pondweed, both invasives, and then coontail, which is a native plant that grows in excess. Test project activities are proposed to be, as I said, exclusively in the main lagoon, and all waters in the development are Tier 3 outstanding national resource waters, with the exception of Lake Tlac there at the south end of the development. The blue areas on the slide represent ownership by the property owners themselves. The red areas represent ownership by the Tahoe Key Property Owners Association. This scenario image of the development, the Lahontan Water Board previously issued 5 NPDES permits to the Tahoe Keys property owners between 1975 and 2014, a cleanup of an abatement order in 1999, and waste discharge requirements in 2014. Of note, the current waste discharge requirements have finding that excessive aquatic plant growth within the facility impairs beneficial uses of water, including cold water habitat, navigation, water contact and non-contact recreation, and possibly rare, threatened, and endangered species. The main elements of the current waste discharge requirements that Keys are regulated under require the Keys to implement water-based controls with an integrated aquatic plant management plan and land-based controls with the new non-point source control plan. In addition, they're required to annually report aquatic plant cover and type. Under the current WDRs, only non-chemical methods are allowed for aquatic plant control, and historically seasonal harvesting and other non-chemical controls like bottom barriers have been implemented since the mid-1980s with limited success. Current surveys over the past several years indicate approximately 160 acres of 170 acres are infested with aquatic invasive species, and or target species, so that would include kingtail. So to provide an idea of the scale of the problem here, the yellow outline on the exhibit here is kind of the forebay as you enter from the lake, represents the area that all other marinas on the lake would fit into. It's about 20 acres. I think approximately 80% of all of the marinas on the lake are less than 1 acre in size, and that's represented by the red square at the entrance there to the West Channel. And 50% are half an acre or less in size. The next largest marina is in Tawa City and is 6 acres. So we're dealing with the system here that's basically 30 times the size. The largest non-chemical method control tests conducted to date have been conducted on approximately 1 acre, or the currently the most current non-chemical control methods, and those were LFA and UV tests, UVC light tests at Ski Run Marina and Lakeside Marina. Scaling up these non-chemical methods to treat 170 acres is a challenge for the project. The Tawa Keys property owner submitted an individual NPDES permit application and base plan exemption for the prohibition on discharge aquatic pesticides. In 2017, it was a limited test project. The project team conducted an initial study and determined that a full EIRES was required for the project. Following exceptional effort by TRPA and our federal agency partners that Joanne described to secure funding for a joint EIR-EIS for the project, the property owners submitted new applications to the Water Board for a 12-year full-scale treatment project. Following stakeholder input and work by the collaborative work by the project team, that proposal was subsequently modified back to a limited scale test project. The property owners proposed to test direct, large scale, and localized target aquatic weed treatment methods, methods to shift sediment and water quality in the long term to provide less favorable conditions to aquatic plant growth, and methods to control fragment dispersal so we're not reinfesting already treated areas or new areas of the lake. And Dennis Sabaglo will now come up and provide us some information on aquatic invasive species in the lake and in the Tawa Keys. Thank you.
Good morning. Dennis Sabaglo, for the record, Aquatic Resources Program Manager for the Tawa Regional Planning Agency. I'm responsible for overseeing the sound implementation of the Aquatic Invasive Species Management Plan Joanne mentioned, signed by both governors and also approved at the federal level. As Russell mentioned, two of the invasive species we're concerned about, Eurasian water milfoil and curly-leaf pondweed, exist pretty abundantly within the Tawa Keys, along with the native species growing somewhat out of control, coontail. The image on the right shows some of the control locations we've done throughout the lake. We've had quite a bit of success achieving localized eradication in several locations throughout, especially the North Shore. And using traditional methods, but from a non-chemical standpoint, bottom barriers that block photosynthesis, diverse assisted suction, and hand pulling. As I said, we have achieved quite a bit of success, but at very small scales, maybe 1 to 2 acres for each infestation. But if you can imagine, this map is almost like a wildfire containment approach, kind of hitting the hot spots, learning a lot of lessons, and kind of closing in on that ground zero, which is the Tawa Keys. But on the South Shore, because of the spread, we do have several infestations along the South Shore. So we're trying to use those lessons and now tackle our largest problem within the Tawa Keys. The Tawa Keys, as Russell mentioned, it's 170 acres of waterways, almost entirely infested with Eurasian water milfoil, coontail, and curly-leaf pondweed. It's 30 times bigger than any project we've done to date. The largest success we've had is at Emerald Bay, which had about 6 acres infestation in 3 discrete locations using those traditional methods. But scaling that up to 170, we're not sure if our traditional methods are going to work. Bottom barriers have shown to be very effective in some of these smaller locations, but given the conditions of the Keys, the scale, the size, there's not a real true hard bottom within the Keys to put those bottom barriers. There's a thick organic muck layer, if you will. So there's nothing for those bottom barriers to sit on in several locations within the Keys. So we need to really find the right methods, and so this methods test is going to help us do that. So we really need to balance what's right and going through the right process to ensure we're going to have the right tools at the end of the day. So this gives you an example of some of the spread of one plant in particular, curly-leaf pondweed, in the upper left from 2015. Not a lot of growth of curly-leaf pondweed, but as you go through time, that infestation has grown pretty rapidly and spread and almost taken over in a lot of places over curly-leaf, over Eurasian water milfoil. Curly-leaf pondweed is more of a concern to us, especially because the biological structure of it has the seeds it produces like this pine cone type seed. It's very hard and durable. It's called a turion. They can live within the substrate for many years. It also, the plant itself also has a much greater propensity to live in the lake proper. And so that's where the big concern comes from. It can really withstand wave action and colder temperatures. So preventing that from spreading out to the lake further is certainly a high priority for us. This is another example of all plants within the Keys. This is in April of last year. The blue represents not a lot of density of plant growth, but the greens, reds, yellows represent the growth. So in April, as you might expect, colder temperatures, not a lot of growth, but just 3 months later, it's just taken over. So we really need to figure out the right tests or the right methods. So a little bit of history of the Keys. In the 70s, they did have a water circulation and treatment system that was put in place, and also they purchased their first weed harvester. They're still doing weed harvesting to date, mainly to support navigation. The problem with weed harvesting is that it's just mowing, giving it a haircut, so to speak, and that creates more fragments, which just create more plants, unfortunately. They did a rotovating field trial in the 80s. This is just a big tiller going through and tearing everything up. It's almost like a nuclear option. They've investigated that to be done currently. However, because of alum that was added to the system, I believe in the 80s or 70s perhaps, as a flocculant, that resuspending that could create severe toxic levels of aluminum within the system. So probably not a good option. So in 95, they applied to this body to use aquatic herbicides, but because of the prohibition, obviously, that petition was denied. And then in 2010 is when we really started seeing that really big outbreak of curly-leaf pondweed. And then 2014, the waste discharge requirements by this body and the Lahontan Regional Board, which includes several items with a non-point source with phosphor, and they implemented a phosphorus fertilizer ban, lots of homeowner education as part of that, and then the Keys also developed an integrated management plan to deal with the different methods and doing a self-evaluation of methods that they might be able to use in the future. And, of course, a lot of education and outreach. So in 2013 through 2017, they did quite a bit of studies and convened an expert panel of weed scientists throughout the country, both at the state level and at the federal level, folks that most of people in my world are very familiar with, and lots of tests and studies of nutrient cycling and nutrient sources. And then they've also done some pretty significant preventative measures as we're trying to figure out what the right solutions are, trying to curtail that spread from the Keys into the lake proper, partnering with the League to Save Lake Tahoe, implementing a boat backup station. It's just, if you remember that map Russell put up in the yellow area, it's kind of the main part of the Keys channels where they put in some buoys that allow boats to go through and safely back up for a short period of time that just puts your prop in reverse and throws any collected weeds that may have attached prior to going out into the lake proper, and then also complementing that is a pretty simple technology. It's called a bubble curtain, and it's just a hose on the bottom of the channel that's putting up a thin wall of bubbles, and that those bubbles can reduce the amount of fragments that are going out into the lake, not only at the surface, but in suspended in the water column as well. And that bubble curtain is kind of put in a V-shaped pattern, pushing it off to the sides of the channel where they put in these C-bins, which are active collectors collecting fragments, and then their staff goes and empties them on a periodic basis. So that's proven to be an effective tool, but it's not the long-term solution. In 2017, I think Russell mentioned, they applied to both this board and to the TRPA to do an integrated methods test project for the use of herbicides, with initial study, initial environmental checklist that resulted in several data insufficiencies on the TRPA side and potentially significant impacts on the CEQA side, and that drove the need for where we are today to do a complete environmental impact statement, environmental impact report. And as Joanne mentioned, this is a collaborative process, so trying to make sure we're getting all perspectives on what should be done. And so I'm going to turn it back over to Russell to talk about the next steps. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. So the current framework for the proposed test project has been collaboratively developed in the stakeholder project. Jen Mayer will discuss that process next after I go through these few slides describing the test project. Test project is structured to demonstrate safety, efficacy, and utility of the methods tested, both when independently deployed or deployed in combination, to enhance water quality and minimize reinfestation. Feasible large-scale treatment methods, methods feasible for small-scale spot treatment, are being identified with input from agency and public stakeholders. Now, the large-scale treatment methods we're defining as or labeling as Group A methods. Spot treatment methods that aren't feasible to scale up to large areas, we're defining as Group B methods. A key element of the proposed test project and any future full-scale treatment approach is to treat early in the growing season. When snowmelt is filling the lake, hydraulic gradients are pushing water from the lake into the Keys. This approach is expected to minimize impacts from die-off of large areas of plants when we treat them. That would be DOSAG, release of nutrients, that kind of thing. And also minimize the required mass of chemicals to be used if that ends up being a selected alternative or preferred alternative in the process. The proposed treatment plan is to treat large areas using these Group A methods and to gain control of the infestation and then follow up with the Group B methods to maintain that control. And the idea is that you would use Group B methods in years following the Group A treatment. So the Group A treatment would happen in the first treatment year, and then the following years you'd use only Group B methods to maintain that control, ideally. Throughout the treatment process, methods will be employed to control plant fragments, dispersal, in order to prevent reinfestation. Treated areas are infesting already are not treated areas. And then long-term methods will be deployed to shift water and sediment quality, as noted. The test project methods will be tested in triplicate. Three control sites will be provided. Test areas about 28 acres in total. And the goals of the project are to reduce target aquatic weed infestations as much and as soon as possible, to help protect Lake Tahoe, bring target aquatic weed infestations to a manageable level, and improve water quality of the Tahoe Keys lagoons to reduce potential for these weeds to come back. Proposed performance measures for the project are to achieve and maintain at least 75% reduction in the target aquatic weeds, achieve and maintain a minimum of 3-foot vessel hole clearance year-round, and increase the occurrence of desirable native species. The current discrete target aquatic methods that will be tested are still being evaluated via the environmental analysis based on input from both the project applicant, project team, and the stakeholders. Project team is evaluating those methods, and we'll be selecting group A and B methods for testing. Selected group A methods will be methods that, again, can feasibly treat and be implemented over large areas. Group B methods are follow-up small-scale treatment methods. Preliminary methods that are somewhat on the table and may be evaluated includes large-scale UVC light treatment, aquatic herbicide treatment, spot treatment with UVC light, bottom barriers, and hand pulling. Preliminary long-term methods that may be evaluated for shifting water and sediment quality include laminar flow aeration technology, which is being tested right now at Ski Run Marina and within the Tahoe Keys, and then targeted water circulation within the Tahoe Keys to try to break up some of the thermal and stratification that occurs within the lagoons. Preliminary fragment control methods, Dennis mentioned the bubble curtain C-bins and boat backup stations. Those methods are all being tested under a separate effort right now by the Keys. And the discrete alternatives that will be evaluated, again, are still being developed by the team. Again, we drew on the Tahoe Keys Property Owners Association application, the project team's input, and then public and stakeholder input as we developed this. We will certainly include a no-project alternative, and we've had input from stakeholders that that alternative should be subjected to rigorous analysis, and that's what we plan to do, to provide a baseline as to what would occur if we were to do nothing about the problem. So we'll do our best to make that evaluation for the Tahoe Keys as well as areas around the lake to the extent we have the resources to do so. Wanted to provide this example of kind of how we might combine group A treatment methods. This is totally hypothetical. It's not being implemented. May not be implemented. We're, again, still evaluating methods and alternatives. But this is an example that gives you kind of idea how these things might go together. The solid white line on the slide represents the area that would be treated with UVC light. The UVC light is basically an array of UV lights on a boat that's dropped into the water. The technology in its current form cannot treat or can treat open unobstructed areas feasibly, very rapidly. But it cannot treat areas under docks or riprap banks and areas with obstructions. It takes him a long time to keep and move that boat array around to treat those areas. So we would, in this scenario, treat the open areas with UVC light. The green line on the upper part of the slide there would represent an area around the docks and channel banks where aquatic herbicides could feasibly be used to treat those obstructed areas. And the green line would represent a also represent like a double turbidity curtain to partition the area off from non-treatment areas. As noted, the project team is currently working on finalizing the project description and scoping based on scoping input and developing criteria and selecting alternatives and methods to be evaluated in the environmental analysis. As noted, some tests are currently underway, including a 6-acre laminar flow aeration test. These tests will inform our process and are being conducted as separate efforts by the property owners. These field tests and our field studies by our consultants and team will be continuing through fall 2020 to collect baseline data. And the project team anticipates initiating environmental review in the fall of this year. Notice of preparation, 3 public scoping meetings, tribal consultation, and approval of the initial project monitoring plan, peer review group have all been completed at this time. We anticipate the draft EIR, EIS in spring 2020 and the final in winter 2020. And I will note the slide is in error that should read winter 2020, not winter 2021. Jen Mayer will now provide an update on the stakeholder and public process for the project.
Good morning, Chair Pumphrey and members of the board. My name is Jen Mayer. I'm a senior facilitator with Zephyr Collaboration, and we've been hired to help manage the stakeholder and public engagement for this process. This morning, I'm going to review a bit of this about the stakeholders who are engaged, the multiple means of engagement that we've designed for the project, some of the stakeholder input and the progress that's made to date, and touch on the scoping workshops and the public comments received during those workshops. First of all, as you know, there are quite a few stakeholders engaged on this. It's been going on for decades. So there are quite a few Tahoe locals who have been following the project, including those who live in the Tahoe Keys. There are also many partner and permitting agencies here, due to the two states, as well as the Fed, and other interested organizations and individuals. Because of that, we've designed multiple means for engagement and input for these stakeholders. We've just completed the first round of public workshops for scoping. There'll be another round next summer when the draft is released. We've set up a project website, thetahokeesweeds.org, that goes through extensive background information on the project, and we will continue to update that as the project evolves. There are two levels of stakeholders who are involved here. The first is the stakeholder committee. We meet every month or so. And the second layer is a broader circle of stakeholders. Those are partners in implementation and other interested parties. And we meet 2 to 3 times a year to update them on the project as well as receive input. The stakeholder committee is made up of TKPOA, the lead agencies, as well as the League to Save Lake Tahoe, the Tahoe Resource Conservation District, and the Tahoe Water Suppliers Association. The broader consultation circle, we meet a few times a year, and that's the partner and permitting agencies. Some of those are the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, Nevada Department of Environmental Protection, and the State Lands Commission. There are many others. And other interested in organizations, that includes the Sierra Club, Tahoe Fund, and California Tahoe Conservancy. The stakeholder committee has made good progress based on the intractable problem that this has posed to the lake. And so the progress that we've made centers around 2 points. The first is that we've garnered agreement to allow for 2 seasons of data collection to inform the environmental document. So that meant an adjusted timeline. And again, the goal is to be in front of the board for certification of that environmental document in early 2021. The second main point of agreement that's been mentioned is the original application was dialed back. That original application was for 12 years of management that included the use of herbicides. And after much deliberation, we were able to garner agreement around revising that application to include a few years of studying various management methods that would then inform a long-term adaptive management plan. Based on that agreement, there was a collaboratively developed project description. This project description we took into the scoping workshops earlier this summer. There were 3 scoping workshops. One was here, one at TRPA, and one on the North Shore. During those workshops, over 100 comments were collected by the public. And following the workshops, the initial count was 160 as far as comments received, and that has been revised up for a total of around 300 public comments to consider for the scoping report. Key themes heard during those workshops and from the comments were questions and concerns about potential impacts of the various management methods, including the no action or doing nothing. There were many suggestions for various ways to manage those weeds and improve the water quality, some of them not currently identified in the project description that are being taken into consideration. Here's just a quick visual of the themes of those comments. There were a lot of comments around the test protocols, around how the tests will be analyzed, including the anti-degradation analysis, and many suggestions for various alternatives, including alternatives that would modify the keys in some way, shape, or form. With that, I'll turn it back over to Russell to talk about future regulatory considerations.
Thank you, Jen. So this board has not yet adopted a exemption to the basin plan prohibition on aquatic pesticide discharges since those provisions were added to the basin plan in 2015. The staff have received a number of applications and been working with a number of applicants for the exemption, however. So when the board sees an item like this, they'll consider a number of items, including final CEQA determination, application for exemption to the basin plan prohibition, with all the required items as specified in the basin plan, and a draft general or individual NPDES permit, and possibly any 401 certification associated with the project. Our intent is to bring all items to the board for approval in one sitting in the spring of 2021. Following completion of the final EIR, EIS in the winter of 2020, again, I point the slide is wrong. That should read winter of 2020, not winter of 2021. If the preferred alternative selected through this process does not include use of aquatic herbicides, then clearly a basin plan exemption will not be required. If no chemical discharge is proposed, it would constitute an NPDES discharge. So aquatic dyes, aquatic herbicides, then no NPDES permit would be required. And we're anticipating that likely most of the non-chemical methods can be permitted with 401 certification. So there may not be much for the board to do if those outcomes fall out of the process. So the basin plan specifies a number of items and findings that have to be submitted for granting an exemption to the basin plan prohibition on aquatic pesticide discharges, including demonstrating compliance with state and federal anti-degradation policies, demonstrating that the minimum discharge of aquatic herbicides is proposed for an effective treatment, and demonstrating that non-chemical methods have failed to treat the target plants. The individual NPDES or NPDES permitting associated with the project also requires compliance with anti-degradation. It's part of Lake Tahoe. The Tahoe Keys Lagoons are Tier 3 waters, outstanding national resource waters. They were so designated for their outstanding ecological and recreational value. State and federal anti-degradation policies specify there should be no long-term degradation within Tier 3 waters. Short-term water quality degradation is allowed within the pesticide treatment application and treatment areas, however, not in the receiving waters. And the duration of water quality degradation will be informed by the environmental analysis, review and analysis. Current EPA guidance is that short-term water quality degradation is weeks to months, not years. The board will have discretion in specifying the duration of water quality degradation meeting that definition of short term when considering projects of this nature. Similarly, the board will have discretion in determining if the applicant has demonstrated they've exhausted all non-chemical methods. So that may come as a summary of past experience with data or a narrative as to why particular method would not be appropriate or meet the goals of the project. So in closing, I'd like to ask if there's any concerns, questions that the board has that we've not addressed here at this point or stage in the project, and invite any guidance the board has to offer at this time on discretionary items required for approval of basin plan exemptions to the prohibition on discharge aquatic pesticides.
Thank you. I think I'd like to ask for board questions from any of these presenters at this point. Mr. Dias?
Yes, I have a question for Russell. Good presentation, by the way.
Thank you.
But earlier you indicated that the original project was to be a 12-year full-scale treatment project, and then it was revised to a limited 5-year test project. Why was it downscaled?
So let me clarify. Initial application was for a test project that was approximately 18 acres and included aquatic herbicides. And we did an initial study on that project and determined a full-scale EIR, EIS was required. The Catawba Keys went back. They didn't have funding for that full-scale study. And while they were huddled figuring out next steps and how to proceed, TRP and our federal partners secured the funding for them, right? So they came back with the revised application, and we had encouraged them because we wanted to know, what is your idea for a full-scale treatment, right? There's implications if, you know, we're talking about year-in, year-out use of aquatic herbicides versus a one-time shot, right? So they came back with the 12-year plan, which was very insightful to see what they were thinking a full-scale project would look like. And we engaged the project team, stakeholders, or formed that project team with TRPA and the other stakeholder committee, stakeholder consultation circle that Jen mentioned. And over a couple months and working the project, we made the determination early this year, and we started work, this is in 2018, on the project as the project team with the federal funding. So earlier this year, we decided as a collaborative group or as a team to pull the project back again to a test project. So that's how the evolution of the project went. So.
Okay, thank you. No more questions.
Okay.
Board Member Cox.
Thank you, Chair. What an amazing presentation. I think we've got all the right players around the table to help come up with a solution. I don't have a lot of familiarity with the keys. What is the depth of water that we're talking about in the channels and in the 20-acre marina area?
I believe the average depth ranges from 12 to 18 feet. Does that sound about right, Dennis? Yeah, 12 to 18 feet.
In the channels and the marina?
The main channels. Oh, you're talking the east channel, the marina.
Little,
I believe that's similar, right? 20 maybe at max?
Yeah, 25 in that main.
25 in the main lagoon. I believe that was dredged a number of years ago. So they routinely do dredge that. So we're talking about the east channel here in the marina.
Okay.
Dennis Baglo, TRPA. In this area here, this is what's called the main lagoon on the west channel. That's about 25 feet. There's not a lot of weed growth in this area in particular just because of the depth.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I look forward to seeing the final solutions come forward for the board's consideration. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Dr. Horn?
This is a been very helpful to me. A number of the, I've just been ticking off questions I have as they've been answered. If you already answered this question when Keith asked his question, I apologize. But what was dropped between the 12-year project and the 5-year project? So what will the 5-year project not achieve that the 12-year project would have?
Okay, great. So the 12-year project did include a validation study very similar to the proposed test project that would occur within the first 2 years of the full-scale treatment project. And that validation study, if all boxes were checked, everything looked good, then the project or the proponent, project proponent, would implement the full-scale plan in years 3 through 12.
Okay.
So they did have provision in there to treat up to 35 acres per year via follow-on treatment with aquatic herbicides. So the proposal was an initial herbicide treatment and possibly other methods to obtain control within year 1, followed in year 2 by the group B or spot control methods, and using those methods again years 3 through 12, but with the provision to treat up to 35 acres per year with aquatic herbicides if needed. So that was the original full-scale treatment proposal.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds to me like basically the 5-year project is taking a breath after the first stage of the project to see how the rest of the project might be implemented?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, slide 8. Slide 8. Which is Tahoe Key's existing conditions, showing 2015 to 2018. There you go.
There we go.
So what treatment methods were used in that time period?
Bottom barriers, diver-assisted hand pulling, and that's it, right? Harvesting, yeah. The harvesting to prevent fragment generation when boats pass through the lagoons.
Just the bottom barriers were very minimal tests. They weren't very effective because of the fact I mentioned they were not really able to put anything on the bottom. Places where they did do bottom barriers, plants just grew on top. So there wasn't really a lot of treatment here. This is just trying to explain the rapid growth of curly-leaf pondweed over time. Okay. So as Russell mentioned, most of the efforts to date have been harvesting with some pilot scale tests of other treatment methods.
Okay, so why did plants grow on top of the bottom barriers?
Fragments recollect, sedimentation on top. It's not an uncommon phenomenon in other areas that we're seeing also.
Okay.
Yeah, the boats disturb the bottom sediments and the currents developed, you know, when they're passing through, and those settle on top of the barriers.
Okay.
And then they have plants that can grow on top of the barriers as well in that dirt. So.
Same question for the next two slides going from April to July. What methods were being applied then?
Bottom barriers, diver-assisted. Pilot level bottom barriers and diver-assisted hand pulling.
Okay, so the same three, basically.
Yep.
Okay. Okay, what else do I have here? Okay, slide 14, which is the one, test project overview continued.
I'm sorry, I don't have slide numbers. Is that it, or is this
that,
one?
No, the other one. There
okay,
you go.
Great.
So I was curious what drivers of aquatic weed growth are being targeted here. So, for example, what do I have? So the organic matter in the substrate, water temperature, circulation. So, I mean, these look like outputs, you know, the result of the drivers. And is the project addressing the drivers of weed growth?
So we're still really in early stages of the environmental review and analysis. And you know, the Keys have done a lot of work. If you go to their website, you'll see, you know, long list of studies and reports they've done on everything from the input of goose droppings to nutrient balance to atmospheric deposition, so on and so forth. So, you know, I wouldn't want to get too much into it, but we do know that there is high phosphorus in the groundwater. The sediment muck is high in nutrient. The stratification results in anoxic dead zones that, again, make that organic matter convert to ammonia, which is a preferred food for Eurasian water milfoil. So we got a lot of dynamics going on that we're evaluating with the environmental analysis and the baseline studies that just were initiated this summer. So we're very early in the process.
Okay.
We'll have more to report on the causes or sources of the problem as we present the draft document for your purview. So.
Yeah, I'll be very interested in hearing more about the drivers and how the project might address them.
Yeah, and that's a key part of this initial study. We have TRC consultants and ESA helping us with that conducting that review, basically. So they've worked a lot on the lake. They're a high-caliber outfit and very knowledgeable with respect to the lake dynamics and okay. Lake dynamics in general. So,
cool. Okay, let's see. Okay, the beneficial uses. You ran through the beneficial uses that are being affected pretty quickly, and I printed out the basin plan, and I have them all here. but rather than going back to which ones are not being met, so which beneficial uses are expected to be improved from the test project?
Certainly contact, non-contact recreation. The water quality and habitat, rare habitat.
Okay.
We're hoping to create, you know, more habitat for native species.
Mm-hmm.
The weed problem within the lagoons now does encourage some non-native fish species and so forth. So I want to get on top of that as well.
Okay.
And, encourage native fish and wildlife to use those areas.
Okay. So does that include the cold water freshwater habitat?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. On the reverse is which beneficial uses could be harmed by the test project?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It depends on how you frame that, right? You know, we're having treatment, so we're going to impact water quality during the treatment period, correct?
Right.
And that's supposed to be short-term, so that would affect many of the beneficial uses because we will, you know, likely be restricting access to treated areas to maintain control and be able to properly test, right? So I think there may be a number that would be effective during the treatment. I think in the long term, our expectation is all would be improved.
Okay. So. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just a comment then. I became aware of a concept called negotiated regulation, which sounded like, how is that legal? when I first heard about it. So this whole framework that's being set up sounds to me very much like negotiated regulation, which I think is the key to solving a wicked problem like this. And building trust, which is something Joanne mentioned as being very important. So this is a very exciting. I know it's tough. I know it's complicated. But I think you're right that this is the way to go.
Thank you.
Mr. Jardine.
Thank you. I really appreciate all the work that's gone into it up to this point and look forward to moving on. and building trust. Dr. Horn, you're right on. going back to slide 23, I'm looking at public and stakeholder engagement and comments. And exploring the fourth item, modifications to Tahoe Keys Lagoons, how far did you go into that?
This slide here? Is that what you're looking
at? Yes.
Yes. Again, we're right in the midst. We just concluded scoping, so we really can't speak much to this, the output of that process while we're, you know, compiling the information, preparing the scoping report, and preparing to revise the project description. But we did hear, you know, a lot of different ideas from filling the keys to drain, dredge, and then refill. Isolating the keys from the lake, this kind of thing. So there were a lot of proposals brought forth.
Yeah, and that'll be in the final report?
Yes, we will have a section on the alternatives and methods that we've selected and why we selected those and the alternatives and methods that were not selected and the reasons those weren't selected. So
I'll look forward to hearing about that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sandell.
Good morning. Is there a public health problem created by these invasive species? And if so, what's the nature of it?
Yes. I would say there's, you know, potentially a direct and indirect impact of the target weeds we're looking at. They're a threat to swimming, obviously, entanglement and drowning as a direct threat. In the indirect way, when we harvest the weeds, as they do, to prevent fragments from the boats going through the growth, and even if we didn't harvest the weeds and the boats went through the growth, you break the plant material, you get some release of nutrients, you get fragments, which eventually will settle and decompose. And you have those factors working.
So not particularly serious.
So those factors can drive HAB outbreaks, which are harmful aquatic algal blooms.
We're aware of that.
Yes, and those can cause serious impact to both animals, pets and wildlife, as well as humans.
But there's nothing direct. There's nothing poisonous within.
No.
Okay. What is done with all, if you kill all the weeds, what do you do with the carcasses?
So currently the harvested material by the Keys is taken over to their corporate yard and dried, and then it's trucked down out of the basin into, I believe, to a landfill or some something like that in Nevada. So that's my understanding. And then the material that dies in water, which, you know, anything not harvested or treated and removed, if it's treated and dies within the water column or as a natural seasonal process when the plants senesce in the fall, that dead material falls to the bed of the lagoons and decomposes. And Dennis mentioned that's what creates that deep organic muck that's very hard to attach bottom barriers to, and it also provides that nutrient source, again, combined with anoxic conditions or even aerobic conditions. You can produce preferred plant food for the various plants via those processes.
Is part of the plan to deal with all of this to remove that bottom muck?
So one of the technologies being tested right now in Ski Run Marina and within the Tahoe Keys is laminar flow aeration, and that has shown some pretty incredible results, both at Ski Runs. It's been in there since last year. And within the Keys, they're already, after 4 months, seeing some pretty incredible reduction of the organic muck around the diffusers. And basically, the longer you run the system, the further that effect goes out from the diffusers, and diffusers are spaced, a certain distance apart. So,
assuming that that turns out to be a good solution, is the Keys prepared to commit to the long-term operation of those diffusers?
I believe so. I cannot speak for them, but we can cross that bridge when time comes, and I believe they are amenable.
Well, they've had machinery in the past that they've installed and not used.
I'm not aware of that, but
they had a whole treatment plant where all the alum came from offline.
It was taken offline, but it was used for a while.
Yeah,
right? So,
but not.
Yeah, not currently, and it hasn't been for a long time. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Talk to us about the UVC. What's used to generate the UVC?
So the developer of the technology basically has built a pontoon boat and a very large, I think it's 12 foot by 12 foot, perhaps bigger at this stage, light array that's waterproof. He mounts generators, gasoline-powered generators, or actually I think he's using propane-powered generators, if I recall correctly, so we don't have a liquid fuel spill threat on the lake. And he powers those light arrays with those generators.
And what generates the light?
It's basically like a LED light array. Like one of these fixtures here that's waterproof.
So
These are fluorescents, but yeah, I believe he's using LED technology, which is low.
They're LEDs, not quartz tubes with mercury vapor.
Yes, he's using correct. LED technology.
So they're LEDs.
Yep.
Okay. So how much exposure time is required to produce a result?
I think he's shooting for like 2 minutes, if I remember correct. But it depends. Yeah, he's still – we've had one pilot project at Lakeside Marina, and I believe 2 years of data on that project. And it was very successful in its initial year of treatment. The following year, the plants appeared to grow with less vigor, and that there are, I believe, did he treat this year as well, second year? Dennis will talk.
Dennis Baglow, Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. The first test in Lakeside Marina is pretty small scale, and the amount of time it's necessary to kill the weed, if you will, depends on the density and how big the plant is. And so the earlier you can treat, the less time it will take, the less dense, the less time it will take as well. He's been doing anywhere from 30 seconds to 5 minutes. He's going to be expanding how long. So we're going through a second pilot project within Lakeside Marina now to learn essentially a prescription of some density factors, growth, height factors to find an actual time frame that needs to be exposed.
So how far away can you be from a plant and still be effective?
He'll be learning that as well, but right now he's trying to get down as close as possible so that light array he has is able to be dropped and lowered into the water column so it's almost touching.
Okay, so quite close. And then he's raising it to catch the whole water column. You can't just start turning on at the top and leave it. You have to lower it.
You have to lower it. It kind of flattens them out, and so you're kind of already getting that exposure to the whole length of the plant because it lays flat.
If you had something like that was in a pattern, then you could move the whatever it's floating from along and treat a whole channel, perhaps.
That's what he's investigating now, correct.
And that would be effective for a season?
Potentially. The initial study or initial report we're getting now is that the regrowth was significantly less than areas that weren't treated. And so similar to other methods that we're using, it's not
less
a one-and-done.
Less than how quickly?
I'm sorry?
Less regrowth, but how quickly did it reoccur?
It started growing the following season.
Season, okay. Yeah. So if you were to do the treatment again, you'd expect perhaps you'd be progressively knocking it back every year even further?
Correct. That's the idea.
Okay.
The technology will not get the turions, though, anything buried in the sediment. And then just so you have a good picture, what he does is he drops the light array and he basically mows the weeds down at a very slow pace. So he gets the contact time and he pushes them over.
Right,
so that's
okay.
That's how he does it.
Interesting. Thank you. Thank you both. Okay.
I have just one quick question. After the conclusion of the test project that we're talking about now, then, will there be a subsequent actual treatment project brought forward?
That remains to be seen, but that's what we anticipate, and that there would be either a supplemental EIR EIS or a whole new one, right, for a follow-on project, in addition to a new NPDES permit for the full-scale project and a new base plan exemption for the full-scale project.
So we anticipated all of my other questions, so that was very well done.
All right.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have three comment cards. Madonna Danbar.
Good morning, Chairman Pumphrey, members of the board, public, staff, members of agencies and partners. My name is Madonna Dunbar. I'm the executive director of the Tahoe Water Suppliers Association, and I'm the resource conservationist for Incline Village General Improvement District. I just want to offer some comments on being involved in the process. We've all been involved for many years on this project. I have to say, working with Zephyr Collaborative and being in the center core stakeholder group, it's a lot of work, but we're making a lot of progress. We all have common goals. The water suppliers in the end may not agree with the final plan, but we feel, in parts of the final plan, we still feel that we're anxiously awaiting the CEQA documents because we really want to see that evaluation of all the potential methods that are available and see where we go from there. But this has been we're making progress, and everyone agrees we do have to do something. This is a huge threat to the lake. Our concerns remain focused on protecting the drinking water filtration exempt status of 6 filtration exempt members at Lake Tahoe. So whatever methods are used, we're going to be, of course, requesting excellent mitigation so that project areas' impacts to the Greater Lake are minimized on our drinking water concerns. And we're especially excited about the UV potential. And I am personally tasked with researching an AmeriCorps team that does diver-assisted removal up in New Hampshire. And could we have an AmeriCorps team or volunteer divers that support our professional divers for those Group B methods? Everyone has to stay focused that if herbicides are used, it would be a one-time deal, not the long-term methods. So my efforts are going to be into helping provide support and information and research on those Group B methods that are going to really pan out to be our long-term maintenance. Thank you all for your time and your participation in everything you're doing.
Thank you very much. Laurel Ames?
Good morning. I'm Laurel Ames, representing the Sierra Club. And I have been involved in this since 1958 when they first started digging it up out there. And I will tell you that even in the very beginning, the lagoons were pretty awful. They would fly in their clients that they were going to sell these lots to, and the night before they would fly in and flock the waters so that they would be nice and clear. And because the weeds hadn't really started to grow in the very beginning, they could get it down and make it very clear. I don't think you could do it today, but they don't sell lots like that anymore. One of the things that I and the Sierra Club have a very big concern with is the use of the herbicides. Excuse me. And in reading the documents that have been produced so far, this project is all about herbicides. They've already decided that the other methods don't work well enough. And when you read the NOP, I mean, almost every other paragraph is about the herbicides. It's not like they're the last resort. It's they are the first resort here. And we're very concerned about that. We propose a final solution, and that is restore the lagoons to the marsh they were. And that's actually not nearly as difficult as some of these other things. And it has the added advantage of being permanent. So you're not going to have to go and do maintenance every year. You're not going to have to redo whole sections of lagoons. So that's our solution, and we've been working on it for some time. There were people at every one of the hearings that testified that, why don't you just close it off? And if you closed it off, you would start returning to a marsh fairly rapidly. And other than that, I can tell you that it's always been a mess down there. Thank you.
Thank you. Jesse Patterson?
All right, is this on? All right, we're good. Good morning, everybody, Chair, members of the board. Thank you for letting me speak today and listening to this very important issue. My name is Jesse Patterson. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer for the League to Save Lake Tahoe, also known as Keep Tahoe Blue. A little bit of background, we're a 62-year-old organization, environmental nonprofit, almost 100% funded by the private sector, have over 7,000 members in almost every state and dozens of nations around the world, mostly because I think everyone that comes to Tahoe loves Lake Tahoe. Wants to talk about it and wants to come back. That includes me, and I'll be staying as long as it'll keep me. You know, our mission is to focus on water quality, water clarity, pristine shoreline, healthy forest, in balance with all the folks that get to live here and enjoy this place. So it's about finding that balance and enjoyment for this generation and future generations. My background, I was an aquatic biologist. I did policy work. I also did environmental economics or the valuation of environments like Tahoe. I think all of those things are reflective in this issue and in Tahoe. It's nice to monetize the value of Tahoe, $5 billion. Makes my job easier as an economist. But all of this is reflected in the issue we're dealing with here, which is quite complex and quite long. I've been working on the issue for about 7 years, since early 2013 with the Tahoe Keys property owners, your agency, the TRPA, all the wonderful partners that came up and spoke today, as well as several others. And the short version is the problem's worse now than it was 7 years ago. So that's a long time for the problem to continue to get worse. So we're currently moving slower than the speed of plants, which is pretty slow. So I think we could probably speed that up a little. I'll keep this brief, this end part, but we support this testing proposal before you. We want to see the environmental review and the process play out, but we're supportive of it as it stands today. We're also involved in the center core stakeholder group and are very engaged. So some things to consider. Status quo is not working. It's totally unacceptable. It's actually making it worse. The current methods we have in the toolbox are inadequate for the size and scale of the problem in the Keys. Lake Tahoe's shoreline conditions are becoming more similar to the Keys conditions, meaning that the plants can now spread and grow along a lot of Tahoe's shoreline, and it's looking like that's going to be more and more the case moving forward, so the sense of urgency is growing, in my opinion. And this proposal before you is about testing new methods and testing combinations of existing methods. And what I like about that is we're going to learn something, hopefully in a controlled, safe, and mitigated manner, so we can then apply that to a new approach that could be the long-term approach. So we're really looking at it as a stepwise approach, which is why we supported breaking the 12-year into this test, followed by whatever we learn coming later, with a whole nother set of public input and environmental review, which I think is essential to make sure we make the right choice. It's important we act, but it's important we act in a way that's responsible and doesn't make the problem worse. So a couple things I'll end on. I think a shoreline full of plants at Lake Tahoe isn't what anybody wants, especially because those plants provide habitat for more dangerous invasive species like warm water fish and things that could affect the ecology of the lake in ways far greater than we are here. And as a recovering scientist and ecologist, everything I've studied is it's really hard to undo biology and ecological changes once they're in place. So we want to be really careful with allowing sort of these invasives to take over and change the ecology of the lake. And also, if we can't move at the speed of plants, I doubt we'll keep up with the fish and everything else that comes with them. So what I'll end on is, we are taking this very seriously at the league. We're following it very closely, and we want it to be done right. But I think at this point, action is the best step, and learning more is the best step. And I think the process set out here and the people involved and the way it's been engaged is the right step forward. And I encourage this board to learn as much as you can. Ask me questions. I'd love to meet with you and talk with you about any questions you may have. But we know what we're doing now isn't working, and it's time to take a step forward. Thank you.
Thank you. I would just add one thing. I'm hopeful that there does not come to pass a hiatus between the conclusion of the testing project and the initiation of the work that needs to be done to gain the approvals for the longer-term treatment project. Because I think that things would not move forward if you have a gap of some considerable amount of time. It takes forever, seemingly, to gear up to go through the permitting for the second project. So I hope that some, and I see nodding, so I'm not the first person to ever think of this clearly, but I hope that there's work going on now, really, to put together the proposal for the second long-term project, should there be one, so that we don't fall back and lose whatever gains were made during the testing. So with that, I'd like to take a quick recess and break until 10:05. Thank you. I'd say half an hour, 45 minutes. Yeah. I'd say at least a half hour, but we don't have the people here to do it yet either. So, okay, item 9 on today's agenda is consideration of the question of constituents of emerging concern. Okay, now we do.
So thank you, Mr. Pumphrey, and members of the board. My name is Jahal Kass. I'm a staff engineer in the Victorville office, and we'll be discussing constituents of emerging concern, also sometimes called compounds or chemicals of emerging concern. This morning I will abbreviate and use the term CECs for short. We do have two guest speakers as part of this item that I'll briefly introduce now. Dr. Elaine Kahn from the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment and Laura McClellan from the Division of Water Quality. Get the appurtenances working here. This is an outline of my presentation this morning. I will introduce the categories and classes of constituents of emerging concern, or CECs, and then have a discussion about the impacts to human health and the environment from those constituents, a discussion of challenges in dealing with and managing CECs, and then we'll shift to how other agencies are involved with CECs at the broader state level, briefly the federal level, and the other 9 regional boards. Come back and talk about what our staff are doing in different program areas, and then the next steps that we'll be working on for CECs. CECs are defined very differently by the different diverse fields of public media, academia, and the regulatory agencies, and they include the endocrine disrupting compounds that also overlap with pharmaceuticals and personal care products, but also include things like flame retardants. Endocrine disrupting chemicals can have a very detrimental effect on the body's endocrine system and produce adverse developmental and neurological and immune effects in both humans and wildlife. In the regulatory realm, CECs are that broad category of chemicals that are not commonly monitored or regulated. Only about 200 chemicals have established regulatory criteria, while there are millions of chemicals that are unregulated and unmonitored. All chemicals without an established regulatory criteria can be considered a constituent of emerging concern. Not all unregulated, unmonitored chemicals, of course, have adverse effects, but there's a lot of uncertainty here. The State Water Board recently updated the recycled water policy in 2018 and used this definition, chemicals of emerging concern are constituents in personal care products and pharmaceuticals, antimicrobials, industrial, agriculture, and household chemicals, naturally occurring hormones, food additives, transformation products, inorganic constituents, microplastics, and nanomaterials, a very broad category. This slide shows the intersection of many CECs, and you see because of the circles and the overlap that it's not a clearly defined set of lines of the road when it comes to CECs. And I have to get the right clicker here because this one is the one to use. Here's where you have pharmaceuticals and personal care products, but you also have pesticides, those endocrine disrupting compounds that can also include different hormone growth inhibitors, cyanotoxins in the environment, microplastics, nanoparticles. These are the perfluoroalkyl substances in the upper left. that I've abbreviated here as PFOA or PFOS, as well as flame retardants. Some CECs are human-made, and some others are naturally occurring. Many CECs are designed to benefit humans in industrial, commercial, and common household products, but some CECs do have unwanted biological effects on aquatic organisms or public health when inappropriately disposed or then released into the environment. There are several ways that CECs are released to the environment, such as through domestic wastewater discharges to rivers, oceans, and percolation to groundwater, also stormwater runoff and agricultural return flows may contribute. These CECs are entering surface and groundwater aquifers and are being detected in water supplies in trace quantities and concentrations. Scientists and researchers have observed and reported that these small amounts may be contributing to severe public health effects and may damage wildlife and aquatic life in the environment. And although the human health effects of CECs at low dose exposures are not all known, some CECs are capable of disrupting many parts of the endocrine and hormone systems. Human exposure to CECs are not fully understood, and some CECs may result in diminished intelligence, altered behavior and development, decreased immunity to disease. CECs may cause significant impacts on aquatic wildlife, such as interference with animal hormone systems and microbial antibiotic resistance hazards. Firm science-based research is only beginning, and the knowledge of CEC effects remains fairly limited in scope. This is an area with more questions than answers. I'd like to shift to the challenges of managing CECs, a number which are listed here on this slide. Numerous estimated tens of thousands of known and unknown CECs are discharged into the environment. Improved grouping categories are needed to classify certain types of CECs based on the many different characteristics of chemical composition and effect. And as mentioned, diverse CEC definitions are used in these different fields of the media, the regulatory agencies, and academia, and there is a need for some more standardization of terminology for better communication. The variety of CEC analytical methods are not all standardized or even developed, and regulatory agencies do not have accepted or established protocols for analysis of all the CECs, and without standard methods, a very important task in managing CEC data is data quality control to keep track of constituent concentrations and accurately analyze and report them, because in many cases we're dealing with concentrations that are in the parts per trillion level, very low. Toxicity information for CECs on human and animal life is insufficient because CEC research is limited. And in the field of domestic wastewater, it appears, at least to me, that most of the research is directed to aquatic systems, surface waters, and their effects of those organisms, or to recycled water and its application and its effects. Limited staff resources, both at the board and the state as a whole, and finances with dischargers that might be requested to do analysis or make controls of CECs are a fact of life. The laboratory analytical costs are often high, and the available laboratories to analyze for CECs are few. Matter of fact, to my knowledge, in Region 6, Lahontan region, there are no laboratories that are certified for many of the CEC constituent analysis. There are other laboratories in the state, of course. The State Water Board has observed that implementing CEC source control and pollution prevention program is necessary to achieve the human right to a safe, clean, affordable, and accessible drinking water. The knowledge of CEC statewide in many different programs is under development with continuous research on risks to public health and the environment. The State Board works internally with many agencies, such as the Division of Water Quality and the Division of Drinking Water, and the 9 regional boards. The State Board has engaged science advisory panels and use outside groups, such as the Southern California Coastal Research Project, or SCWRP, to provide valuable data and technical expertise to develop and implement monitoring strategies that are effective to evaluate the effects of CECs. Monitoring for CECs is a requirement of groundwater recharge and reservoir augmentation projects. This is a requirement of the revised recycled water policy. We've included within attachment A of the recycled water policy, which discusses CEC monitoring for those 2 applications. That would be reservoir augmentation and groundwater recharge, or indirect potable reuse projects. The State Board's Division of Drinking Water, or DDW, identifies that water quality contaminants are a serious issue, and evaluating CECs is an ongoing requirement that may result in subsequent regulation, such as establishing drinking water primary or secondary contaminant levels. In 2019, just recently, the DDW established notification levels for the perfluorinated substances, and these are for PFOA, 5.1 part per trillion, so it's very low, or for PFOS, 6.5 part per trillion. In addition, the State Board is pursuing strategies for microplastics. There are other agencies directly or indirectly involved in CEC studies. The Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment develops recommended notification levels and response levels when a chemical is found in drinking water sources by conducting risk assessment analysis. The Department of Toxic Substances Control implements a Safer Consumer Products program using a 4-step science-based process to reduce toxic chemicals in products that consumers buy and use. The United States Environmental Protection Agency, for 2 programs, the Safe Drinking Water Act for potable water and the Clean Water Act for water quality protection, has programs to collect data for the drinking water side. The Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule, or UCMR, collects data on contaminants in drinking water systems. And then the US EPA also has a program with 9 very large wastewater plants nationwide. These are plants like Philadelphia or Boston, or probably some West Coast cities as well, to collect data on CECs from effluents and effluent discharge effects, and publishes those data. And not shown on the screen, but I would add that also the U.S. Geological Survey has a nationwide program to evaluate CECs in both surface and groundwaters. I think it's called the Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program is one, and I forget the groundwater equivalent. Shifting to the regional boards, this is not a comprehensive listing on this slide of what other regional boards are doing, but it does show how other boards are conducting studies of wastewater effluent, surface water, sediment, and fish tissue for CECs and their effects. The North Coast region monitors in the Russian River. The San Francisco Bay region has been working with their dischargers for some time now, and they've developed a collaborative program to where the major wastewater plants that discharge into the bay have pooled resources into a consortium that then provides the funding for a San Francisco Bay-wide study of CECs. Down in the Los Angeles region, the Regional Board 4 has required some wastewater plants to test and monitor for CECs, and then they also work with those dischargers and other groups to evaluate CECs in the San Gabriel River, Los Angeles River system, and the Santa Clara River system that discharges near Ventura and Oxnard. The Santa Ana region is doing work in the Santa Ana River watershed, but also along the Orange County coastline. And now I'll shift to our region, the Lahontan region, and the different program areas that are involved in CECs. And these involve airports and landfills, military facilities, surface waters, and to a limited extent, wastewater plants, as well as the harmful algae bloom program. And as earlier discussed, the State Board has issued Water Code Section 13267 investigative orders to airport and landfill facilities to investigate PFOs, or the perfluoral substances, in groundwater. The perfluorinated substances are a large group of man-made chemicals that are commonly used as surface coating and protectants to provide resistance to heat, water, and oil. And while those substances are no longer manufactured in the United States, they are still used to some extent and present in the environment. Exposure to these chemicals may cause adverse effects, including birth defects, cancer, liver damage, immune response defects, thyroid damage, and increased cholesterol. In the Lahontan region, two airports and 26 landfills received this order and submitted work plans to staff. And currently, the Water Board staff are reviewing those work plans. And when data are collected, then that will be shared. Water Board staff also work with the military bases, the Department of Defense facilities, which has had a nationwide program to investigate the PFOS, perfluorinated substances, in both soil and groundwater. The target for those facilities to investigate those areas within a base where perfluorinated substances were likely to be released or present, such as their main drinking water wells, firefighting training areas, aircraft crash sites where flame retardants may have been used to suppress fires, and then those would have been released. And from there, we anticipate that they will expand their studies out to things like their landfills on a base or their wastewater plants. The State Board has developed a public dashboard of CECs under the SWAMP program, Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program. And if I said that in regard to the USGS, if I use the same acronym, the USGS has a different acronym. The SWAMP program, I think, provided that dashboard last night that Kelly Huck showed you, and that's data that was collected from 1993 through 2016, and that dashboard has a map showing the locations as well as the data collected. So that would obviously include more than CECs in their data set. It would also include what I would say conventional parameters or regulated chemicals. In the monitoring reporting programs associated with some waste discharge requirements, the Water Board has required monitoring for some endocrine disrupting compounds such as perchlorate, metals, and phenols. In addition, some wastewater treatment plants analyze, this is within the region now, analyze CEC in their effluent either independently or in collaboration with other groups. And then recently, some CECs were detected at low concentrations in the water supply springs that feed the California Department of Fish and Wildlife's Hot Creek Fish Hatchery near Mammoth Lakes. The Water Board staff is investigating potential sources of those CECs. The Harmful Algae Bloom Program conducts cyanotoxin monitoring and posts public warning signs when certain levels are exceeded that generate a public health concern. The next steps that Water Board staff will be pursuing in regard to CECs are shown here. The Water Board staff does recommend that the State Board expand its scientific studies for CECs to include the effluent discharge from conventional septic tanks or on-site wastewater treatment systems, as well as raw sewage percolation ponds, which we still have in the region. Water Board staff will work closely with other agencies to evaluate and coordinate CEC-related activities, such as the results of those 13267 investigative orders for landfills and airports. And then for groundwater recharge projects that would use recycled water, we have one that has been proposed. This is the Palmdale Water District's Little Rock Creek Irrigation Project. We would include, as required by the policy, CEC monitoring in the monitoring and reporting program. This now concludes my presentation, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to answer questions or invite the next speaker.
Actually, what I would like to do, and I apologize profusely for this, but I think we have an opportunity now to do our closed session, and I think that we ought to do it now so that we disrupt the remainder of the meeting as little as possible. I have been thinking about this for 3 days and still haven't found a good way to do this, so I'm going to conclude it doesn't exist and ask that we go into closed session at this point. I don't know, is it easier for us to go to the little room outside rather than asking everyone to clear this room and shut down all the video equipment? Seems like it probably is.
Yes, the room is available if you choose to use it.
I think that would probably be a more convenient and easier way to do that. My estimation is that we will be about 30 minutes or maybe a little more in time. I'm very sorry to have this interruption. Again, I apologize for it, but we're under a time constraint with respect to this item, so thank you.
Board Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
May I have a word? Just wanted to clarify that we're going into closed session on matter 1H, discussion of personnel matters, and when that's concluded, we'll return to this item.
Thank you very much. It's always good to have someone who remembers how to do things correctly. Again, thank you very much for your indulgence. So we're ready to resume our consideration of item 9.
Jay, did you want to introduce the next speaker? All right.
I can introduce myself.
Thank you.
I'll let Laura do that. Good.
Thank you very much for your patience.
All right. Good morning. Good morning, Chair Mumphrey and members of the board. I'm Laura McClellan. I'm a senior environmental scientist in the Division of Water Quality. I'm the chief of the Recycled Water Desalination and Constituents of Emerging Concern Unit. And today I'm going to talk about this ongoing process that we've been going through at State Board to develop a statewide management strategy for CECs. Also with me today, I should point out, is Dr. Scott Coffin, who is a research scientist in the Division of Drinking Water at the State Water Board, and his work is on microplastics and CECs with the Division of Drinking Water. So I'm going to start with framing the magnitude of the issue and some of the challenges associated with developing any kind of management strategy for CECs. I'm going to highlight our statewide CEC initiative. And then I'm going to touch on some of the ongoing research efforts that we are undertaking to help fill some of the research gaps. And then I'll circle back on our path forward for developing this statewide management strategy. So I'm primarily going to be focusing on the Division of Water Quality's activities, but I'll also talk a little bit about some of what the other regional water boards are doing. So Jay basically gave most of my presentation for me. Thank you, Jay. You don't need me at all. So one of the challenges with CECs is defining them, as you heard. They are diverse, and there are many broad categories of CECs, and they include not just all of the compounds listed on screen, but also degradates and byproducts of those compounds that may have combinatory or mixture effects. So that's one of the things that we need to be thinking about. And then they're at various stages of emergence. On some, we have a lot of information, both monitoring data and toxicological information. On others, we have very little information. And that's always going to be the nature of CECs, that some are going to be emerging, some will be emerged, and then we need to be moving forward toward regulating those compounds. So as of 2018, there were approximately 156 million unique chemical substances listed in the Chemical Abstract Service, indicating exponential growth since 2000. Thousands of compounds are added each year, and this doesn't include those degradates and byproducts that I was mentioning. So some of these constituents continue to be analytically challenging, and we need to continue to develop methods for monitoring those. It may seem like some of those challenges are insurmountable, but we have to start somewhere and we have to be doing something. The standard monitoring paradigm that we have for our normal regulatory approach isn't sustainable for CECs, as it's a revolving door of chemicals that may come on a list of concern and go off a list of concern. And it's also not feasible to address millions of chemicals one by one. So a lot of what we're talking about is, what are the tools in our regulatory toolbox to protect water quality and public health when we do find something, particularly when we don't have all the answers? So we really need to be building public trust and develop a management strategy that uses a transparent public process. So as Jay mentioned, over the last few years, the State Water Board has commissioned a number of expert panels and research studies to make monitoring recommendations and identify a framework for prioritizing which CECs to be monitoring for in recycled water and in ambient ecosystems. So some of these panel reports have directly informed regulatory developments, such as the 2013 panel and the 2018 panel that evaluated CECs in recycled water, as well as the 2016 panel that was convened by the State Water Board Division of Drinking Water to look at the feasibility of developing regulations for direct potable reuse. Other of these panel reports, such as the bioanalytical screening research that we've been undertaking, have further helped inform the development of analytical methods, and we're continuing to fund research along those lines. So one thing I want to emphasize is that even when panels provide us recommendations for CECs to include in some kind of regulation, such as the recycled water policy, CECs are inherently investigatory. So it's not the same kind of compliance monitoring paradigm that we have for most of our regulatory processes. The recycled water policy requires monitoring for a list of CECs. However, the recycled water policy also requires us to reconvene every 5 years the science advisory panel to reevaluate their recommendations for which CECs may be required to be monitored for. And some of the CECs that may be required currently may not be required into the future. So today I'm going to focus on a science advisory panel report that came out in 2012 and provided us recommendations for monitoring CECs in ambient aquatic ecosystems. So the panel was composed of subject matter experts in areas of expertise, including human health and environmental toxicology, biochemistry, civil engineering, analytical chemistry, and pathology. And this diverse areas of expertise were critical because of the types of questions that we were asking the panel to consider. So I'm not going to cover all of the findings of the panel, but the panel recognized that there's a need for comprehensive CEC monitoring tools to help address the lack of information that we have on CECs. And they recommended a suite of targeted chemistry, bioanalytical tools, and non-targeted analysis to help address those monitoring needs. So targeted chemistry is where you have a chemical, you know what you're looking for, you do the analytical method for that chemical. It's what we typically think of for water quality monitoring. So that's your known knowns. For bioanalytical tools, that's a term that encompasses a broad variety of biomolecular techniques to assess potential effects of CECs on human health and wildlife based on known adverse outcome pathways, so a mode of action. So basically a cell is engineered to respond to a certain class of CECs, and when it when a response is triggered from that class of CECs, you would get usually fluorescence in a cell sample. So that's an example of a kit there. And that can help you identify, okay, there's something estrogenic in this sample. We don't know what it is. So now we can go and do some targeted chemical analysis to try to figure out what that compound might be. And then the third one is non-targeted analysis, which is a broad term that includes a variety of analytical techniques that can be used to address the unknown unknowns, to use the Rumsfeld term. and we like to think of it as molecular fingerprinting and forensics to help identify those unknown compounds. So the panel recommended a three-tiered monitoring approach for CECs that included bioanalytical and targeted chemistry first to try to identify what may be present in the water sample, and then follow that up with non-targeted analysis and further targeted chemistry analysis to try to identify further what are in some of the water samples. And then once you've identified specific compounds that are present, go back out into the field and confirm that they are, in fact, the ones that are there. So the panel recommended monitoring for inland surface waters, effluent-dominated water bodies, coastal embayments, and ocean waters. And they used a risk-based approach to try to figure out which CECs we should be looking for in those different water body types. So they looked at all of the occurrence data that we have for California and then any known toxicological risk levels that we have and compared the occurrence data with the risk levels. And if the occurrence data was higher than a risk level, then they would recommend that CEC to be monitored for in that particular water body type. So that's, when we talk about screening chemicals, that's often what we're talking about. That process needs to be done on a regular basis as more monitoring data are generated and as we learn more about the toxicological effects of some of these CECs. So the panel's recommendations were implemented to varying degrees at the different regional water boards. Some regional boards have been interested in CECs for a long time, and others have done a few studies here and there. But really, the regions were tasked with implementing the recommendations of the 2012 panel and piloting their framework for evaluating CECs to see if it works for California. So this is just a quick summary of some of the regional board actions to date. I know you can't read it. I'm not going to get into the details, but our job at the Division of Water Quality is to coordinate between all of these different activities going on and collaborate to develop a more cohesive statewide management strategy for that. So the CEC initiative is that current iteration of that strategy, and that coordinates monitoring efforts going on in the regions. Using the panel's framework, our eventual goal is to be continuously recommending CECs for monitoring and also off-ramping some CECs. We coordinate with other agencies in Cal-EPA, such as OEHA, the Department of Toxic Substances Control, Department of Pesticide Regulation, and others. And our goal is to have a comprehensive strategy that works sort of like an Amazon packaging facility. So where you have a new CEC that comes onto the scene, it would be on-ramped into the facility. There are different tools in our regulatory toolbox to be able to evaluate the proper regulatory response. And then as we learn more about some CECs, as we know more about their toxicological effects, we may choose to off-ramp them and cease to monitor for them. And then for other constituents, we may choose to move forward with developing an MCL or a water quality objective. But in all of those decisions, they need to be based on robust data. So that's one of the biggest hurdles for us. And it's clear that whatever strategy that we develop has to be nimble to accommodate for new information that comes through. So the CEC initiative has three phases, to compile existing knowledge and data, to improve coordination between the different agencies and state and regional water boards, identify data gaps and address them. And then the third phase is to implement the comprehensive strategy. Since the world of CECs is not stagnant, we also need to provide ourselves direction periodically to check in and revise the strategy. I mentioned this approach for the recycled water policy has been really effective to reconvene a panel every 5 years to provide us new recommendations for CECs to be monitoring for. But CECs are bigger than recycled water, and it's really this global issue, so we need to be forward-looking and look for alternative regulatory approaches. This process has to be transparent, and we need to be working on developing significant public and stakeholder outreach to include a strategy for risk communication and a plan for when we don't have all the answers, how to address that. So as we're working to develop that strategy, we're also funding research to further develop analytical screening tools, such as those bioanalytical screening tools I mentioned, also non-targeted analysis, and then identify the CECs that are of greatest risk to human health and wildlife, identify measures to improve source control for recycled water and other water types, and also how to further optimize treatment trains for different classes of CECs. So our funding comes mainly from discretionary contracts. We also have funds for recycled water research, specifically through Proposition 1 and Prop 68. And we're also partnering with research organizations like the Water Research Foundation to help leverage our dollars further. So in this upcoming year, we'll be reconvening the science advisory panel that I was talking about today on CECs and aquatic ecosystems. And this time they're going to look at ambient waters for freshwater estuaries and ocean waters, and essentially do a similar exercise to what they did in 2012 to look back at their framework, tell us if they still think it's the best approach, update it if necessary, provide new recommendations for CECs to be monitoring for, and provide the state with some additional actions that we should be taking at a programmatic level to help address CECs. And then also the San Francisco Bay Regional Board has a contract with the San Francisco Estuary Institute to compile data and synthesize essentially all of the statewide data for CECs to help the panel in its endeavors. So those are two concurrent projects that are going to be starting this fall and this winter. So if you're interested in the CEC initiative, feel free to email me. I can add you to our email list. We also have a website. But I just want to thank you so much for having us here today, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you very much. It's on the slide.
Yes.
Thank you. And I think that we'll have questions for everyone when the presentation is
finished.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Elaine Kahn, and I'm chief of the Water Toxicology Section at the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, otherwise known as OEHA. Thank you for the invitation to come here and speak with you today about OEHA's role in assessing drinking water contaminants. Oh, yeah, it's the wrong one. Okay. So I'll start my talk by going over what public health goals and notification levels are, and also telling you the differences and similarities between the two. And then I'll provide a very general overview of how we develop these numbers, and then talk about whether these methods can be applied to CECs and how OEHA can address CECs in drinking water. But first, I'll start with a little bit of background. The Calderon Share Safe Drinking Water Act of 1996, more specifically the Health and Safety Code Section 116365, requires the State Water Board's Division of Drinking Water to set regulatory standards for contaminants in drinking water. And in this law, it also requires OEHA to develop public health goals, or PHGs. A PHG is the level of a chemical contaminant in drinking water that does not pose a significant health risk over a lifetime of exposure. And PHGs are not regulatory standards, whereas maximum contaminant levels, or MCLs, are. And the state law requires the water board to set MCLs as close to the corresponding PHG as is economically and technologically feasible. So PHGs are based entirely on health, whereas the MCLs take into account technology and economic feasibility. Notification levels are a precautionary, non-regulatory health-based level of a drinking water contaminant that warrants notification and further monitoring and assessment. And public water systems are encouraged to test their water for contaminants with notification levels, and in some circumstances may be ordered to test. And if a water system does test and they find that there's a contaminant that exceeds the notification level, then they're required to report this information to their governing boards and to the water board, and are urged to report it to customers as well. So what are the differences between PHGs and notification levels? A PHG is a health basis for an MCL, whereas a notification level is a precautionary level for a contaminant that does not have an MCL yet. And the process of developing a PHG allows for stakeholder involvement and input through two public comment periods, and it also requires external scientific peer review of the underlying risk assessment. Now, notification level recommendations that OEHA develops are submitted directly to the Water Board. And as far as similarities between the two, both PHGs and recommended notification levels are health-based guidance levels of contaminants based on human health risk assessments. And these levels are typically referred to as health protective concentrations or reference levels. And OEHA derives these values based on the most current principles, practices, and methods that are used in human health risk assessment. To develop health protective concentration or reference level, OEHA uses traditional methods of risk assessment. The first step is to compile all of the relevant scientific information available on a chemical, and this includes studies of the chemical's effects on laboratory animals and studies of humans who have been exposed. And next, we look at the studies of these chemicals, and we analyze the dose response, which is basically looking at the data to see what levels of a chemical will cause an effect in the test animals. And when we look at these data, we like to see increases in the effects as the dose increases, and that reassures us that the effect is indeed caused by the chemical and not some random chance occurrence. And once we identify the best study to use, we use the data in that study to derive the health protective concentration. And if a chemical has been identified as a human or animal carcinogen, a health protective concentration is determined for both the non-cancer and cancer effects. But the problem with traditional health risk assessments is that the publicly available studies that we rely on take lots of time and money to perform. For example, a typical cancer study takes 2 years and uses at least 50 animals in each of the untreated and exposed groups. As I mentioned with the dose response that we like to see, we want to see multiple doses. So you would have a group of animals that aren't exposed, and then you want to see at least two, preferably three doses. You can see a low, middle, high dose, and so you can see this response as the animals get more exposure, they get
increased effects, either in severity or number of effects. And so that's for a carcinogen. And in reality, we say it's a two-year cancer study, but it can take much longer because you expose the animals for 2 years, and then you have to look at all of their organs and process the tissues and examine everything after that. So in theory, it could take several years. And for non-cancer effects, the studies can be a bit shorter, but they still involve a lot of animals. We'd like to see at least 5 to 10 animals in the untreated and treated groups. And again, for the dose response, we want at least 2 treated groups. And we like them to be exposed for a minimum of 90 days. And ideally, there should be more than one study showing the same effect. So, can traditional risk assessment methods be applied to CECs? There are likely hundreds, if not thousands, of chemicals of emerging concern, and some examples have been mentioned today, such as the per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, and endocrine disruptors. Yet we only have health protective concentrations or reference levels for less than 200 drinking water contaminants. And this is because traditional risk assessment methods have so far been limited by the amount of data available, and they don't work very well for chemicals with insufficient data from either animal or human studies. So how can OEHA address CECs? We're looking at new toxicity testing paradigms such as TOX-21. And TOX-21 is a collaboration among 4 federal agencies listed here. And this collaboration was set up to develop new ways to rapidly test chemicals for adverse health effects. And they use high-throughput screening to test chemicals for their potential to disrupt biological pathways that may lead to toxicity. So high-throughput screening uses robotics, data processing and control software, liquid handling devices, and sensitive detectors to enable scientists to quickly conduct millions of chemical tests. And this type of test system is referred to as an in vitro test system. And you can see some of the components in the images here. On the right, you have the robotic system that can move these dishes from place to place within the assay. And on the left, far left, you can see these multi-well dishes. And they range from 96 wells to over 1,500 wells per dish. And if you can imagine, you can set it up so that you can grow cells in each of these wells. And theoretically, each cell should be able to represent one animal. So with this type of assay or testing system, you can test chemicals quickly and cost-effectively using cells instead of whole animals, and the results can help prioritize chemicals for further toxicological testing. So let's say you have one dish and you test chemical X and you look for estrogenic activity. So you get the ones that light up and they show estrogenic activity, so you think, okay, that's a possible endocrine disruptor. We can identify that for further testing and eliminate anything else that's not lighting up. So that's one useful thing that's coming out of this. And also TOX-21 is developing models to better predict how substances could disrupt normal cell function and lead to adverse effects. So while TOX-21 is coming up with all these tools, their high-throughput testing can also be incorporated into one of the new ways to predict chemical toxicity called read-across. And these methods can be particularly useful for CECs because you can test data-poor chemicals with high-throughput systems and compare the results with anchor chemicals, which are the data-rich chemicals that typically would have animal studies or sufficient data to show a dose response and give you a good idea of what's really going on in the whole animal. And then one of the comparisons that can be made is whether or not the data poor chemicals perturb cells or cellular components that in the same manner as the anchor chemicals. And other read-across approaches include computer simulations of chemicals interacting with cellular components. And these methods are called in silico methods. And right now, our scientists are discussing these approaches with federal scientists and academics working on these tests. However, we do have challenges. One major challenge is the lack of scientific confidence in vitro test systems, because cells grown in a dish may not behave the same as the whole animal. And so we still have to figure out how we can extrapolate from single cells in a dish to the whole animal. And on top of that, because these methods are new and many are still being developed, acceptance from the regulated community may be limited and slow. And so we do still have several questions to answer, but we're still working on it, and we hope to make some advances in the near future. And with that, I'll end my talk and take any questions.
Thank you. I think, let me see, first of all, I don't have any speaker cards, so let me see if there's anyone from the public who wishes to speak to the board regarding this item. Okay, so now I'd like to turn to board members for their questions and or comments to the presenters, starting with Mr. Diaz.
Thank you. And thank you for all three of the presentations. They were very informative. I have no questions, but I would like to make the comment that I concur with the recommended next steps as presented on the last slide of Jay Cass's presentation. Thank you very much.
Ms. Cox?
This is just an amazing topic. I think we could spend days kind of noodling through all of the issues. As we're beginning to discover the pervasiveness of these contaminants, has there been any exploration in treatment technologies on the wastewater side that has proven effective with pre- and post-testing? Jay, do you know of any treatment? I mean, we've got UV filtration, we've got all various forms of membrane technology. Have there been any pre- and post-tests for the CECs to see the removal rate of specific contaminants?
That's a very good question, Ms. Cox. I don't have a fully detailed background in that question, but what I have looked at is that the more advanced wastewater treatment systems will have improved removal of CECs along with other conventional parameters. So going to full secondary systems with denitrification or even up to tertiary systems where you get filtration and chlorination, your effluent quality is better, which means you've removed a lot of the parameters. Now, of course, reverse osmosis or filtration systems like that will be your best removal. Many of the wastewater treatment plants, in treating their effluent, result in also removing a lot of biosolids or sludge, and many of these CECs are removed in sludge. So in my a question that I have is, what is the effect of just transferring CECs from the water column to the solids that are then residually applied to soils as an amendment for a fertilizer or something? So, but then I do know that from one paper that actually one of the people at DTSC that I was speaking with sent a report that I found interesting. It's on a constituent known as nonyl phenyl ethyl oxalates. This is DTSC report by the Safer Consumer Products group, and they were looking at the effects of this compound, which is a additive in laundry detergents. And it's not used in commercial household detergents, but it is used in the laundries of the large commercial laundries, like you know, the service laundries or maybe large hotels. And this compound, as many complex compounds are, have different chains. And as the compound breaks down into its more original products the natural, the shorter chains of the chains of the compound, the toxicity increases. So I found that interesting because typically through your wastewater processes, through aeration, you are going to reduce or degrade some of these compounds. So I think the answer to your short answer to your question is yes, higher levels of wastewater treatment will result in fewer and lower concentrations of CECs. But some CECs, if they're present, might result in a higher toxicity in, for example, this compound.
Okay, and I think in hindsight, as we see these pharmaceuticals emerging as contaminants, as we get at least some grasp on this issue, there should be some requirements for the pharmaceutical companies as they develop new compounds that they have to do this testing on the front end instead of us grappling with how to clean it up on the back end for the protection of health and human safety. So look forward to much more on this issue.
The only thing I would add is that different classes of CECs respond differently to different parts of the treatment train. So particularly for recycled water applications, a lot of the discussion by the expert panels that we've convened has been around which treatment processes effectively remove those different classes of CECs. And a lot makes a difference in terms of the order of treatment as well. You may have byproducts that are generated in one area of treatment that can be addressed by something further down the treatment train. So the panel's recommendations for monitoring CECs in advanced treated recycled water, a lot of their recommendations were for compounds that they don't expect to see in finished product water because of the efficacy of the treatment train and how we know the treatment train works. So they had recommendations for monitoring surrogates at various parts of the process, where if you find a hit in that surrogate, then you know that you may have a larger problem that you need to go and investigate. But it's a combination of treatment elements. But again, it's sort of a needle in the haystack. We don't know what we don't know situation, and I think that's where developing regulations for direct potable reuse that the Division of Drinking Water has been tasked with, that's one of the largest challenges that they're addressing.
Thank you.
Dr. Horn.
My goodness. I have no questions, just a couple of comments. One is that many years ago, I did risk assessments and policy evaluations for aflatoxin, if anybody knows what that is, and saccharin. That's how long ago I was looking at these. And became aware of how incredibly complicated, first of all, dealing with toxic substances because of the numbers of them that are out there, and there's no really effective way to deal with regulating classes of them yet. Still so many years after TSCA was passed, and then the difficulties of extrapolating from animal studies and in vitro studies to effects on human health and gathering data from epidemiological studies. I mean, this is really tough stuff. And the chemical companies and pharmaceuticals are way ahead of us. So, and I'm really encouraged to hear how many other people are already working and thinking hard about these issues and that Lahontan doesn't have to solve this problem all by itself. So thank you for that.
Mr. Jardine.
Just a quick comment. I have to agree with Mr. Diaz and Ms. Cox on the importance of this issue. And this is, we need to move forward on this. I've received and reviewed a number of reports on this matter from South Tahoe PUD and from our watershed group. And it is a, you know, this components of emerging concern is terribly important. Thank you for this good report.
Mr. Sandell.
Ms. Cox has asked all of my questions and gotten answers, too. This This is a big issue, as we've all acknowledged. It seems to me that we need to include in the research the ability to know what's necessary to treat, to remove, or render harmless whatever is being found as part of the investigation, perhaps even initially. We're looking for things that we can impose on the regulated community, and we don't have those yet. But it seems like we could get started. Perhaps we can figure out some broad classes of treatment that will work with many things like ozonation or UV or reverse osmosis, which is the most expensive. But we need to get going on that. And not the investigations are wonderful, and we're learning a lot. But what we're really learning is if wherever you look, you're going to find something you don't want to see. So I think we need to get going on treatment also.
I have just two questions. The slide that contained the information about Hot Creek Hatchery made me wonder, do these compounds, are they ingestible by fish and then ultimately by someone acquiring the fish?
Mr. Pumphrey, I do not know the answer to your second question. I'm sure the first question would be yes, because the springs, there's like four springs that feed the hatchery. That's what the fish are living in. So it will be going through their system. Now, whether these compounds, which were, by the way, at very low concentrations, you know, trace concentrations, parts per trillion concentrations in the most cases. I remember a sucralose was in the 1 to 2,000 parts per trillion, which would be 1 to 2 part per billion.
And my other question was, do we then find these compounds at wildfire sites, and are they then subject to re-entering or entering the water system through runoff from these wildfire sites?
I do not know that either. That is a very good
question.
I see
people nodding that perhaps that's the case.
Yeah. So does Scott, please. Introduce yourself.
My name is Scott Coffin. I'm a research scientist in the Division of Drinking Water and with a background in environmental toxicology. Thank you for allowing me to speak. So your question, Mr. Pumphrey, about fish being exposed to CECs. So
I just find it interesting that we're raising fish that we're going to send out into the world for people to take and then take home, and we're raising them in a... using a water supply that we suspect may contain some of these compounds.
So your concern is more on the health, the human health effects of ingesting
fish? I just wondered if it was like mercury, for example, or not.
So for a lot of the CECs that were measured in the Hot Creek fish hatchery, most of those are not bioaccumulative, and you would not expect to see human health effects from exposure to fish. However, you may be concerned about reproduction and development and reduced productivity of the hatchery as a result. And so when considering CEC monitoring, if any of you do consider CEC monitoring in Region 6, it's important to consider which biota may be exposed and look at the most sensitive species, as if the base of the food chain is being affected, that can cause large-scale effects.
Sure.
And the importance of this issue is also that we work with all of our sister boards and departments, you know, because we need to share our knowledge and information. Toxics has a biomonitoring program there where they do study chemicals and its effect on humans as it bioaccumulates. I do know they look at animal studies as well, and they do monitor some wildlife to give them some information. But that's why this is such a complicated issue, and we all have to work together to share our knowledge.
I'm Brianna St. Pierre. I'm with the Division of Water Quality at the State Water Board. I wanted to address your question on the wildfire impacts. I can't speak for all CECs because that's not my area of expertise, but there were studies done specifically with PFAS constituents at wildfires. The flame retardant that's used in wildfires specifically is not the PFAS type flame retardant, so it's not being added. What is also found is the fires are burning so hot, it's actually incinerating the PFAS constituents. So the bad news is the fires are really, really hot and move quickly. The good news is they're destroying the PFAS at the same time. So,
thank
you. Like I said, I can't speak for the rest of them, but the PFAS are getting destroyed.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for a very interesting, a little scary presentation. Item 10, California Water Resiliency Portfolio.
Presentation. I can go with it if that's what you have. It's okay. This is not a trick question. I can go with it. Sure. Got my name on it. There we go. That looks prettier. Well, good afternoon, Chair Pumphrey and members of the board. My name is Sean McGuire, and I'm a member of the State Water Resources Control Board. And I'm hopefully, you know, this has been a very educational morning for me. I've learned a lot just now. And what I'm here to talk to you about really are, you know, how do we merge all of our knowledge and understanding of, you know, California's water challenges and looking ahead into the future under, you know, conditions of climate change, you know, changing environment and other unknown challenges, things like CECs that we're still trying to better understand and grapple with and really prepare our state for a resilient future. This is, and I think you've members of the board, I think you've heard of this before. I came to you a couple of months ago and spoke briefly on the water resilience portfolio. And I'm here today really to gather your thoughts and your insight. This is a listening session, you know, one of many that have been going on around the state, including every regional board. And so I'm looking forward to hearing from you and members of the public about ideas that we can incorporate in the water resilience portfolio that's being championed by our administration. So today I'm going to provide a high-level overview of what that executive order is and what we're envisioning with the water resilience portfolios. Governor Newsom signed the executive order on April 29th of 2019, and he directed the Resources Agency, the California Department of Food and Agriculture, and California Environmental Protection Agency to work in consultation with the Department of Finance and others to prepare this water resilience portfolio. And the idea is to identify short, medium, and long-term planning efforts and ultimately a suite of priorities and actions to help build water resiliency while preserving economic vitality and healthy communities and ecosystems through the 21st century. Certainly lofty goals, but worthy ones for sure. Another effort is also to build off Governor Brown's Water Action Plan from 2016, taking lessons learned from the last drought and the advances we've made in water conservation, integrated water management, protecting ecosystems, and expanding storage, and finding ways to look at those priorities, see what we've accomplished over the past few years, and identify what measures should then also proceed, you know, going forward. We've certainly accomplished a lot, and there's still a lot of elements of the Water Action Plan that are still in progress. So the portfolio also seeks to update climate change protections and funding opportunities. So, you know, why? I'm sorry. Right, see if the slides are the same. So why is planning for the future important? I know your region has been involved significantly in understanding the potential impacts of climate change and insofar as developing an adaptation strategy over the past several years. And but you know, as a state, we have challenges that we're faced with. And we have a growing population. You know, currently at 40 million residents, and by 2050, we could have another 10 million in the state. So when we're talking about challenges with drinking water and understanding constituents of emerging concern and things like, you know, do we have adequate supply in all the disparate areas and geographies and changing hydrologies around the state, those are challenges that we need to better understand. Coupled with that, it's, of course, getting warmer. There's a variety of climate change models out there, but for planning purposes, you know, I think it's reasonable to predict, you know, upwards of a 5 degree Fahrenheit increase on average sometime between 2050 and 2100. And I think most of us have already begun to see temperature increases, and that's truly becoming a reality. And so understanding then what are the implications of that, whether it's reduced snowpack, increased precipitation in areas, increased incidences of flooding, wildfires, increased stream temperatures, thinking about harmful algal blooms and other things. Those are all challenges that come with warmer temperatures. And ultimately, we want to work towards building water supply certainty. And that's not only for human use, but we also have a vibrant agricultural economy in the state, and we want to continue to preserve and protect that. And our aquatic ecosystems have been, in many cases, not had adequate water resources for many decades now due to, in large part, human intervention. And so this is a balancing responsibility that we all have, and the water resilience portfolio hopefully will seek to address some of those challenges. So, you know, how do we get there? The portfolio has a number of priorities, and these are essentially spelled out in the executive order, which I'm sure you have a copy of or you have seen. But we're really looking at how do we leverage multi-benefit approaches? How do we work with our natural environment to provide benefits for our ecosystems and also human benefit? So looking at natural infrastructure and forest headwaters, floodplains, aquifers. How do we use innovation and new technologies, new treatment, forms of treatment? We heard about some of that today with the Tahoe Keys efforts, and I think we need to continue to be innovative in thinking of ways to build water resiliency. Are there new ways to work regionally together, collaboratively, to identify solutions to help build, you know, identify new sources of supply in areas that have been limited or could be limited, especially under future drought conditions? And then, you know, the last two really speak to, as a state, how do we then work better together across different agencies? There are so many different agencies that touch water, touch land use, and have implications on you know, our supply. And there's always room for improvement. So the portfolio will hope to identify some of those. So the inventory and assessment piece, really, I think we'll look regionally across the state at different areas and build largely on the California Water Plan, which was just published, which does much of the same thing, but looking at water supply and demand, what are the water quality challenges in different areas, the projections, looking at a 2050 time horizon, and what will the needs be in different areas. Voluntary agreements for major river systems, that's speaking to the, in particular, the Bay Delta watershed. But I think looking at collaborative solutions to other water systems as well is something that we always look to encourage. Planning to modernize Delta conveyance with a single tunnel project, I'm sure you've heard of that. And I know the Resources Agency is is hard at work to re-envision that project and come up with a new proposal there. Expansion of the state's drinking water program to ensure all communities have access to safe, clean, and affordable drinking water. Again, this has really been a remarkable year. The legislature recently passed SB 200 to establish safe and affordable drinking water fund. And the board's very hard at work now in working to identify those communities that aren't currently meeting primary drinking water standards and working to address those challenges. That's going to be a long-term investment. It's not something that we're going to be able to solve all of those problems overnight. But the state is committed to addressing those issues, whether it's a major urban area or a small rural community or a domestic well owner. You know, we recognize that everyone through the human right to water is entitled to safe drinking water, and we're going to strive to accomplish those goals. And as I said before, reassessing priorities of the 2016 Water Action Plan. This is just an example of the comparison of water use and water supply. I'm not going to go into details on this, but this is something that came out of the California Water Plan, and we could use a similar model now for the Water Resilience Portfolio Report. And so a lot of the portfolio, frankly, is built on the knowledge and the input from the state, from stakeholders who are engaged, you know, in different areas on different subject matter experts and are really able, through our combined knowledge and understanding of the challenges and opportunities that we have, to offer, you know, innovative ideas for the future. And so this has really been led through the Resources Agency, and Nancy Vogel with the Natural Resources Agency has been tasked with leading this over the last several months, and I have not envied her challenge that she's had. She's been through, I'm sure, dozens of stakeholder meetings, probably hundreds of one-on-one meetings, and has been receiving many, many comment letters and emails with ideas and suggestions for as to what the portfolio should include. We at the board, we had an information item in August and have, like I said, gone around to the different regions and had these similar discussions and received a number of wonderful ideas that we've been transferring over to Nancy Vogel. I'm joined today by Brianna St. Pierre, who will be diligently taking notes for any ideas, and we'll be happy to pass those along as well. And we're also engaging academia and other institutions like PPIC, just to make sure that we have a broad cross-section of deep thinkers that are able to contribute to this effort. So it really is encouraging outside-the-box thinking, not saying that the status quo is where we need to be, but really, you know, a willingness to listen and understand new ideas. And my way of thinking this is that there's many, many more ideas than will possibly ever be included in the portfolio itself. But that doesn't mean there aren't a lot of great ideas coming out of this that shouldn't be implemented. And so I think this is just a wonderful opportunity to have a deep think about water and our future and see what comes of it. And so these are just some questions that are offered to you, and certainly not ones that you even need to answer today if you choose not to, or you could discuss something else, but just to help seed your thinking about some of the input that we're looking for, perhaps from the regional boards, such as what are regional water quality issues and how will those issues affect the availability of supplies within your region? And particularly in a region as expansive as yours, Lahontan, and the number of different geographies and different challenges that you face, I think it's important to reflect that here. What state regulatory efforts will help protect and restore local water quality? So how can we help? Are permits sufficiently clear, staffed, and do they achieve their intended outcomes? How could the regional board's role in water reuse help extend local supplies? What are the drinking water needs of the region? What investments should the state make to help ensure long-term sustainability of water quality? And what are the region's most significant environmental protection efforts, and how can the portfolio incorporate the nature of the work, need, and lessons learned? Those are a lot of questions, and we could spend a lot of time discussing any of those, but hopefully helps your thinking with some of the ideas. So today is an opportunity to weigh in for you and hopefully the public as well. Nancy Vogel and Resource Agency have also set up this website, waterresilience.ca.gov, which you're welcome to go visit and find information on. There's a calendar of events there, but I will say that the calendar is running to the end of the calendar because they have been charged with completing the draft recommendations report sometime in October, which is rapidly approaching. So this is possibly one of the last discussions, but not to say it's not important, and we certainly want your input. The other way to submit ideas, if you're not ready today or you want to put some more pen to paper, is to email directly to Nancy at input@waterresilience.ca.gov. So what's next? More public and stakeholder input and engagement. So even when the draft recommendations come out, there will certainly also be a public process associated with that. The draft report will be published, and everyone will have the opportunity to comment and weigh in on that process. So just because we're approaching that time does not mean the conversation needs to end. I do want to highlight that on Monday, this coming Monday, we will be having a discussion on drought preparedness. And so we have a few panels in Sacramento at the Cal EPA building at 9:30 in the morning, 9:30 to noon. And we'll be talking about how ready are we for the next drought, not knowing when that time might come. What lessons did we learn from the previous drought? And, you know, we have a number of initiatives underway, whether it's conservation as a way of life or building more robust water supplies. But I think there's other tools and other ideas that we can look at. And thinking then in the context of the water resilience portfolio, what kind of drought response, drought readiness tools might be incorporated into that. So it'll be, I think, a good conversation, and you're encouraged to attend if you're available. And as I said, recommendations coming out in October, and the hope is to have the final report to the governor by the end of the year. So a very ambitious timeline, but at the same time, again, I'm very excited to see what comes of it. So with that, I will open it up to questions and comments.
I know that we have one person who filled out a speaker card, and I think that might be the start of some input for you for some suggestions and ideas. So I'd like to call on that person and ask if there's anybody else in the audience who wishes to address the item, and then we'll see what the board members have to say as well, if it seems like it might work. Holly Alpert.
Good afternoon, Chairman Pumphrey, members of the board, and Lahontan board staff. My name is Holly Alpert. I am the program director of the Inyo Mono Integrated Regional Water Management Program based out of Bishop. I also want to thank the Lahontan board and Patty for supporting this process in the Lahontan region. I've now been part of 4 listening sessions, and they're outlined in your agenda. And it's been eye-opening for me and very educational, and I think there's some really good information coming out of it. So today I thought I'd share with you a few of the ideas that came specifically out of the Inyo Mono IRWM session that we held about 2 weeks ago in Bishop. This is just a subset of what came out of it, but I think these are some of the bigger themes that we heard. I'll be submitting a full set of comments before the end of the month, hopefully by the end of next week. And I will absolutely send a copy to the board as well. One of the first things that we talked about is that folks there wanted to see more focus on water banking, water spreading, and groundwater recharge, particularly in our region. They brought up the concerns about the increasing extremes in climate, especially the big wet years that we're seeing, and they'd like to see that being more of a practice in our area. Although what we're also brought up are concerns about associated energy and carbon costs that go along with those practices. We will be recommending additional funding and stable baseline funding for integrated regional water management across the state. We would like to see this not be bond funded into the future. There, rural regions like ours don't have large water districts and other agencies that can support IRWM through fees and other kind of mechanisms like that. So we're really dependent on state funding. We'd like to see this be stable into the future. Several people in the listening session specifically cited our particular IRWM group as a real resource and source of information. We would like to see more assistance for small and disadvantaged water systems, for things such as determining appropriate rate structures. That's a real challenge in our region. Keeping up with state regulations, infrastructure upgrades for antiquated infrastructure, technical managerial financial capacity building, and for legal issues. One recommendation that came up was to provide a specific funded technical assistance person in each fill-in-the-blank. It could be a county, it could be an IRWM region, it could be a watershed. So I think that's an interesting idea. We are really lacking water operators in our region. We're having a lot of water operators retire, and we have a lot of water operators who manage several systems. So when they retire, all of a sudden, 10, 11 systems are without water operators. We don't have a lot of new people coming in. So one of our requests, I guess, might be state support to help recruit and train and provide ongoing training to water operators. One of our recommendations will be around general financing of watershed management and water projects, that again, this not be solely financed by bond funding that's unpredictable and episodic, but that we have some kind of stable funding from general fund, or is it a water tax? I'm not sure what the answer is, but the concept is more stable funding. We also, even though our listening session was really for the whole Inyo Mono region, a lot of the discussion focused on the Owens Valley, and some participants expressed a desire to provide more education to the residents of Los Angeles about their water sources and to encourage them to take an investment in their upper watersheds. And then a larger sense, we'll definitely be including comments about connecting downstream water users to their water sources and helping them understand that they really have a stake in protecting their water sources. There is a concern among stakeholders in the Inyo Mono region that the bigger players in water management, especially from the urban areas, will have bigger voices and more influence in this process, specifically in the portfolio process, and in water management in general. So we'll be submitting a comment around that. And then another big concept that came up is that our region has a lot of federal and public land. And there's a frustration that sometimes we're unable to work with, especially federal land managers, around their decisions around land management practices. So there's a desire for, I think, state agencies and locals to be able to work more with federal land managers in our region so that they have a voice in what's happening on land management. And then in the bigger picture, not just connecting downstream water users as individual water users, but bigger picture downstream water user agencies, encouraging them to take more of an interest in their headwater water sources and protect source watersheds and financially invest in aiding the upstream rural communities in our water issues and protecting high-level ecosystems. We particularly talked about forest ecosystems and wetlands in our areas. So those are some of our comments. Like I said, I'll be submitting them to Nancy Vogel by the end of next week, hopefully, and I'll be sure to get a copy to the board as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll turn to members of the board for comments, suggested input, observations. Mr. Diaz.
No questions or comments. Thank you.
Dr. Horn.
Oh, up so quickly.
I should note that board member Cox had to leave to right. To catch a flight.
Okay. So in a board meeting filled with difficult, complicated subjects, we saved the most difficult and most complicated one for last. this is a moonshot. It really is. And, I mean, draft report in October. Good luck, Brianna. and it had, you know, of course, it's going to be an iterative process. First of all, I want to say I agree with everything Holly Alpert presented. Those were all excellent points, and I agree with them. And thank you very much for coming up and making your presentation, and I look forward to receiving a copy of your report. The other thing, so having spent much of my career as an ologist, pick your science, trying to communicate, be persuasive about working on and solving natural resource issues and communicating that with the public, there's a tendency of this is going back to the bullet point about investing in natural infrastructure. There's a tendency of ologists to assume that if you say X will be improved if we do Y, or maybe it's the other way around, that's a good thing, without connecting, saying why, explaining to the public why, or decision makers, why that's a benefit to humans. It just sort of stops at the natural resource level. And so I think it's really important in this exercise to make sure that when talking about, you know, the importance of investing in the natural infrastructure, that the cycle is completed back to how it benefits humans to do that. For example, how doing that improves water supply, how it reduces cost of treatment, how it reduces damage from floods. And one thing that often, this may be a more subtle point, but how investing in natural infrastructure maintains freedom of activity for humans. So, for example, I mean, this has to do with the implications of species getting listed as threatened and endangered. So with climate change and increasing temperatures and the changes in our hydrological cycle, many of our perennial streams are going to become ephemeral. The fish populations, aquatic populations that depend on this flow to live in, are going to be harmed by the loss of in-stream flow. So, I mean, yeah, and so if those fish populations become listed, that then restricts human activity within that watershed. So we maintain our options for our scope of actions by to the extent that we have policies that prevent listings that prevent listings of threatened endangered species. The lawyer from NRDC who's made an entire living suing the water boards using the Endangered Species Act says the whole point is to manage the water supply so you don't ever get to the triggering the ESA. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. Just one last comment. I mean, we tend to think of, this goes to your first bullet point, Sean, about the how water quality might affect water supply. Well, then there's also the feedback loop of water supply, how water supply affects water quality, and that, I mean, the in-stream flow example, that's an example of that where our authority, our obligation to provide for cold, freshwater habitat, which is water quality, is impaired if we don't have water supply. So we tend to think of them as being two different things, but they're interrelated, and, I mean, the arrows go both ways. So that's the end of my comments.
Mr. Jardine?
Thank you for the heads up. It's a wonderful report, and we need to move forward. I am indeed gravely concerned about the weather extremes and climate change and the long-term impacts 50 years, 100 years out. And I look forward to giving comments and look forward to hearing about the comments from Mono Eniel. That's it for me. Thank you.
Mr. Sandell.
Thank you. Yes, I could cede all of my comments space to Holly Alpert and to Amy. That was very complete. Thank you.
This is the fifth listening session I've been to, and every one of them has been productive of a lot of really great ideas. I'm just going to use the fact that I have you captive for a few minutes to just emphasize three or four things. One of the things that I heard over and over again was the idea that there needs to be a really robust, really coordinated, really formal education program for not only adult consumers of water, but in the schools to understand where the water comes from, to understand why it might be important to conserve water, to understand all facets of its use. Another one was, and I can't support Holly Alpert enough, with the idea that there needs to be sustainable, predictable funding for the integrated planning process. It's just really difficult for a lot of rural areas to support those efforts on their own. So what it means is that there are initiatives that get started, then they don't go as quickly or as well as they could have if there was actual support for that. There's not predictability as to who's going to be there in a year, what the agency's going to be capable of doing. And so it really, I'm always amazed at the number of things that people in state government think that the IRWIM would be useful for, and they're right about all of them. They would be useful for all of those things if they had the resources to actually exist as fully functional, robust, sustainable agencies. And it's hard for me to understand how, on the one hand, you can say, I think this is a really important program. It really has a lot to offer, but I don't think it's important enough to actually fund and support. So there needs to be a connection of those two concepts. The third one is that, and this, because of where we live, was heard over and over again, is the idea that there should be resource spending on headwaters and waters of origin areas that's commensurate with their importance within the water system. Downstream use gets the money. Upstream use provides the water. Somewhere that doesn't make sense. And at some point in time, you need to make sure that you're protecting and safeguarding the origin of the resource that you're so concerned about protecting into the future. The last one is a little more offbeat, but I noted that somewhere I read that, and I think this is nationwide, that 19% of the water that goes to support agriculture and food production supports the production of food that's wasted. So there's, I think that tells us that there are conservation opportunities at the end of the chain, just as there are further up and closer to the origin of the water. And maybe we ought to stop. I'm sure that's not just true of food, and I think they just talked about the food product itself, and it doesn't cost or consider the packaging and all of the other things that go into getting the food to a place where it can ultimately be wasted and thrown away. I think that over the long haul, on a long view kind of situation, that maybe we ought to start looking for conservation opportunities at the end of the supply chain. We may not be able to afford forever to be such a profligate society. So if there are there any other comments from anyone? Sean, do you want to wrap us up? Or
I'm Brianna St. Pierre, State Water Board again. I just wanted to let you know that we have these comment cards. They're in the back of the room, and they are also with your Victorville staff to put in that office as well. It has the same information that was on, I don't know how to go back, this page. So if members of the public are available to come into the office, not necessarily here today, they can take one of these and provide comments that way.
Awesome.
Board members, I want to thank you immensely for all of your comments and insight. And also, Holly Alpert, thank you for your input. As someone who, in a former role, helped prepare many integrated regional water management plans for upper watershed areas, including, and you may not know this, the Tahoe Sierra region, your comments are very heartfelt, and I, too, feel that, future investment in IRWM is an important component. I don't know, of course, what the administration will decide in terms of the portfolio and how that will connect or not, but absolutely supportive of IRWM as a useful regional resource. And protecting our headwaters, of course, comes with that. So thank you very much again for your time today and the opportunity to speak before you. And as your state board liaison, I look forward to seeing you again soon, and I look forward to the tour tomorrow as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being with us. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for this meeting. There's no further business to transact, so the meeting stands adjourned. Thanks a lot.